You guys made me feel a lot better. I saw your tweets and your posts. I got a lot of texts. I don't know who's booing. I'm thanking the ones who are not booing right now. I'm thanking everybody who tweeted me from the WWE Universe.
Bizarro World here in Toronto.
How bizarre. How bizarre. How bizarre.
It's business time, baby.
The Solar Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. Delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 508 of the Solar Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, August 13, 2017. I am the Solar Monster. Woke up early this morning so I could catch up on the G1 Climax Finals, which did not disappoint. This is going to be an insanely packed podcast here this week because I'm going to lead off in a little bit here with some thoughts on the tail end of the G1 from the last few nights, including the finals, which ended only a few hours ago. So if you have not yet watched the finals and you don't want to know what happened, you might want to skip ahead when we get to that part. I'm going to talk about the G1. I'm also not going to wait a week. I'm doing SummerSlam predictions. We are 1 week away from SummerSlam next Sunday at the Barclays Center. Once I get through Raw and SmackDown from this past week, I will have SummerSlam predictions. I will have predictions for NXT TakeOver Brooklyn, which is coming up next Saturday, also from the Barclays Center. Just a ton of stuff to get to here on the show. First, I want to show some love to Audible. You guys have been killing it with the Audible link, especially on the Justin Roberts book after that interview I did with him a few weeks ago, which is up on the YouTube channel, by the way. You can use our link, audibletrial.com/solamonster. You could sign up. You get a 30-day trial of the Audible service to try out, see if it's right for you. And whether you keep your trial going beyond the 30 days or not, as part of your trial, you get one free audiobook on me, on the Sound Off, on this podcast. It belongs to you no matter what, even if you cancel before those 30 days are up. You get a free book, audibletrial.com/solamonster. The cool thing is, if you are looking for a wrestling book, you've got a ton of options. You have the Justin Roberts book, but you also have Bob Holly's book. You have Shawn Michaels and Stone Cold and Brock Lesnar and Daniel Bryan and so on and so forth. So definitely take advantage of that if you have not already done so. I also want to let everybody know, I think I mentioned this last week, that there is another new shirt, a brand new shirt up on our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. .com/solamonstersoundsoff. Thank you for all the feedback, by the way. The Solo Mountie shirt is still up there. If you remember our letter that I read here on the show from Vincent a few weeks ago, you'll get the inside joke there. That shirt is up. And the brand new, first ever, Mama Monster shirt is now up in two colors. You can get it on a white shirt or a light blue shirt. I have the light blue shirt, and it looks badass. I actually really like that design, so shout out to Steve, who's supremely talented and helped work on that. So that shirt is up in two different colors right now on the Pro Wrestling Tee store. Of course, Mama Monster herself thinks it's the coolest thing that she has a shirt now, so she's happy as can be. But definitely go over there, check it out, and pick up a shirt. I know she would appreciate it as well. Also, thank you for everybody who made a PayPal donation. TheSolamonster.com. Completely up to you, completely voluntary. If you want to show your support, that is the easiest, most direct way to do so. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. And if you donate $10 or more, it will earn you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. John Loose Cannon Lopez being one of those people. John tweeted me earlier this morning. He was at the NXT Sacramento show live last night. Looked like a fun time, and so Loose Cannon tweeted about a 20-second video. I retweeted it on my page. He wanted to give a shout-out to the Sound Off family, and John, of course, gets his shout-out here on the show. I appreciate all the help. Deadpool James Herrera, thank you for the donation. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Out of Control Cody Thomas, The Florida Freebird Brian Pissera, The Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, Mass Grave Micah Harshaw, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker. I wonder if the Brooklyn Bombers are headed to the Barclays Center for any of the shows next weekend. Stephen, or hopefully our meetup, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, the Bakersfield Brawler, Kevin Velotto, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog, Cody Heartbreaker, Hatch, the Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T., the Show-Off, Corey Van Dam, the Main Attraction, Jackson Scott, and Davis, the Empire, Enos. Thank you very much for all of your support. I also want to say congrats to JD from New York, JD from NY206, for becoming partnered on Twitch. It's very well deserved. And also, OKFabe, I dig the new logo, my man. I know Salrex worked on that for you. He's a very talented guy, so I just wanted to say good stuff. And I think that gets all the shout-outs that I wanted to do out of the way. If you have not yet seen, up on our YouTube channel, I put up a Fire Pro Gamer, a brand new Sound of Gamer video, me playing Fire Pro World for the very first time. First time I've done a non-WWE gamer. And it was a lot of fun. Even though Okada spammed me with about 12 arm bars in my match, I was the Undertaker. Undertaker against Okada, by the way, very interesting match. So if you want to check out my Fire Pro exploits, you can do so on the YouTube channel. I'll be doing more of those videos, and I'm also putting Missionary from Wrestling Soup on notice. I'm coming for you. We're going to figure something out one of these days. It's going to be you against me. We're going to have some fun with that. Progress Wrestling, I know, had a show last night here in Queens, here in New York. I was thinking about going. They only had general admission tickets left by the time I checked it out, but I wasn't able to make it. It looks like it was a hell of a show, despite there being no air conditioning. They packed those guys in there like sardines in a building that probably should not have had that many people in it. And apparently there was no AC. There were a couple of people who passed out. Some fans. It was crazy, but the show itself, by all accounts, was very cool. Pete Dunne had to be pulled, unfortunately. He was supposed to defend his WWE United Kingdom Championship against Jack Gallagher. Of course, Progress has the working relationship going with WWE, so WWE will allow stuff like that. And that was one of the big advertised attractions for the show, but then the night before, Pete Dunne was wrestling at another indie show here in Brooklyn, and he got clobbered with a belt shot that gave him 11 stitches, apparently, in his temple. And so he was not medically cleared to compete. He was there, he did come out, he healed on the crowd and cut a promo, but he couldn't wrestle. Which reminds me, when I think about that, and Pete Dunne, you guys know I'm a big Pete Dunne fan. I'm a big fan of his work. I think he's one of the best heels probably in all of wrestling right now, and should be a lot bigger even than he is. And it just got me thinking, why have we not seen any more of these UK guys? Why have we not seen any more UK title defenses since Pete Dunne had that match with Tyler Bate where he beat Bate for the championship back at TakeOver in Chicago? That was an incredible match. I mean, that's a match that's in the running for match of the year. At least in WWE. And ever since then, it looks like these guys have just dropped off the face of the earth. I mean, I know they're making all the rounds at all the different indie shows. It's not like they're not working. But in terms of WWE or NXT, it's like they don't even exist. And these are some of the better guys, frankly, that they have under contract. I was surprised that Dunne was not booked to defend that title at TakeOver, at least, if not SummerSlam. I think that would have really added to the card. I just think it's absolutely absurd that they have not been, and him in particular, have just not been used since that unbelievable match that he had only a few months ago. We are less than a week away from our Sound Off meetup at the KBH, the King's Beer Hall, here in Brooklyn. There is no age limit. Do not be fooled by the name. You can bring whoever you want, regardless of age. Families will go in there. It's not like a strict age limit or anything like that. It is this upcoming Saturday, August 19th, starting at 2 p.m., just a few hours before NXT TakeOver at the Barclays Center, which is walking distance from where we are going to be. So you can literally walk from the beer hall to the Barclays Center and be there in less than 5 minutes and go to the NXT show. So I hope to see a lot of you there. We've got some pretty good feedback to the invite on Facebook. Pretty good crowd I think we're going to have coming in and out throughout the afternoon. So 2 p.m. this Saturday. I mean, I may get there a few minutes later, but 2 p.m. this Saturday. Hope to see you guys there. This should be a lot of fun. I mentioned before, I'm not going to wait until next Sunday to do SummerSlam predictions. I am going to get to that in a little bit. I want to talk about the G1 first, because I'm still on a G1 high right now. I just got done watching the finals about an hour ago. Again, just as a reminder, and by the way, this G1, the greatest tournament I have ever watched in all of my life, in all my years of watching wrestling, and I've seen, it's not like I haven't seen some of the G1 before, but I made it a point. This is the very first year where I said, I'm going to watch as much of this tournament as I possibly can. I may not be able to watch every single night, but I have my New Japan World subscription, which is absolutely worth it, by the way. And it's a lot easier. When I initially signed up for it a few years ago, I think I signed up for it maybe about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, they didn't even really have an English sign-up page. Now they do. So it's a lot easier now to navigate because I had let my subscription lapse, and then I had sort of re-upped with them. And it's a lot easier now to navigate the website. But I watch most of this G1, at least the key matches, and I can honestly say that it is the greatest tournament that I've ever seen. There will be some spoilers here from this morning, so again, if you do not want to know who won the G1, if you haven't watched the finals yet, I am going to talk about that here in a few minutes, so just consider yourself warned. First up, as far as the A block and the B block, Naito won the A block. He beat Tanahashi. Kenny Omega won the B block this year. Finally, exercising his demons, he beats Okada. I want to talk first about the match that Okada had several nights back against Minoru Suzuki. I think that was, I have it written down here as day 16. Hopefully that's right. That match was absolutely brutal. I mean, these guys got into like a slap contest, and you think to yourself, a slap contest? That's not wrestling. Real men don't slap each other. Well, you haven't seen this match, okay? I shouldn't even use the word slap. I mean, there's got to be a word that's like stronger than slap. It wasn't a punch, like somewhere in between. You could see the sweat flying off these two with every slap. So many open hand slaps, probably too many, honestly. But these two had a hell of a match. They went to a 30-minute draw. Okada had hit the Rainmaker at the finish, but he couldn't crawl over in time to make the pin. Just an absolutely brutal match, but, you know, told a good story with Okada. Just, you know, obviously Suzuki is the grizzled vet. Okada, it's hard not to think of Okada as a vet, but he's still so young. And when he's in there with Suzuki, you know, certainly he's not the vet. But he fought back and he just ran out of time there at the end. I just thought that was a great match. Which brings me to Okada Omega 3, which took place Saturday, yesterday morning, in the finals of the B block. They somehow found a way to top their first two matches. I know some people are going to disagree with me on that, but I honestly think this was the best of the entire series that they have had. And I will say, Okada Omega is as good as any trilogy of matches that I have seen in all my years of watching wrestling. Okay, and people talk about stars. I already had some people tweeting me, how many stars do you give it? You know, how many stars do you give the match? Who cares? Who cares? I don't do stars. Meltzer does stars. Other people do stars. I don't do stars. I watch the match, and when it's over, I know if the match is great or not. And I have yet to see these two guys have anything less than an excellent match. And the thing is, like, each one was different, right? I don't remember how long the first match went, the one they had back at Wrestle Kingdom. It was probably close to half an hour, I would imagine. I think this last match that they had yesterday was probably, it had to be the shortest of the three, which is not to say it was short, but it was probably of the three the shortest one. Obviously, the middle one went to a 60-minute draw, but quantity does not always, you know, automatically make something the best. This match yesterday, I would say, went probably somewhere around 25 minutes. It was the perfect length, I thought, for a big main event match. Not too short, not too long. Told a great story. Omega trying to get that first win over Okada, trying to hit the one-winged angel, going all the way back to January. He could not hit that move on Okada. He tried a whole bunch of times. Okada would always reverse it. He would escape. He would find his way out. And look, and this is a criticism of New Japan. Far too many kickouts of big moves. A lot of high-impact moves like kicks and knees and far too many kickouts. And I'll give you that. You're not wrong about that. That, and by the way, that's not just a New Japan problem, that's a wrestling problem. Because you see that in WWE, you see that on indie shows, you see that all over the place. It's not just a New Japan problem. So, for all the V triggers and all the Rainmakers and the Rainmaker attempts and all the kickouts that followed, all it took in this match was one move. Omega finally hit the One-Winged Angel. It got the big reaction that you knew it would when he finally hit it, and he won with it. He got the pin. Now, on top of that, you have the story with Okada's neck, sort of like Tanahashi's arm, which is legitimately messed up. Okada's neck, I mean, look, I don't doubt that Okada's neck, everyone's neck after this tournament is probably jacked to all hell. But here it was part of the story. He had the tape on the neck in the last few matches that Okada had in the tournament. Omega just kept dropping him right on his neck, right on the back of his head. He gave him a reverse Rana on the floor at one point, gave him the Snapdragon suplex on the apron, all this punishment to the neck, and Okada just would not give up. But in the end, proved to be too much. Omega won with his finish. I love this match. I love this match. The best trio of matches I've ever seen two guys have. All due respect to Flair and Steamboat. You know, what's scary about Flair and Steamboat is that by their own admission, they had much better matches than the ones that we all remember from 89. I mean, the only people who ever saw them, I guess, were the people in the buildings the night that they happened. But those guys would wrestle sometimes twice in the same day in different cities. And they're like, yeah, you know, as great as that series that everybody talks about that we had in 89, we had matches that were much better than that. That's kind of scary to think about. I'm not trying to minimize what they did. But Okada Omega is now in that same class. It's no longer just Flair Steamboat kind of put up on a pedestal up here. You have to put Okada Omega up there as well. And really, that's the best compliment, I think, that I could pay this series of matches that these two guys had. Now, one other thing I wanted to mention here was the English commentary. I think the English commentary on this for this match and really the last two nights deserves an honorable mention. I watched it on New Japan World in English. I normally don't mind watching and actually prefer watching with Japanese commentary, but I went with the English this time. It was Kevin Kelly, Don Callis, and they had Rocky Romero in there with them as a guest commentator. I thought they were fantastic during this match. Really added to the drama during all the key points. So I just wanted to give kudos to those three. I mean, really, Kelly and Callis make for a great team. I didn't know what to expect because I liked Kevin Kelly and Steve Corino as a team. I know some people just hated Corino, but I liked them going back to their work in Ring of Honor and even in New Japan. So when Corino left to go to WWE, and honestly, I'm kind of bummed that he didn't get an announcing spot on NXT. Although the announcing they have there now with Mauro Ranallo and Nigel McGuinness is fine. But I didn't know what to expect because I wasn't familiar with Callis' commentary. And to Callis' credit, apparently he wasn't even all that familiar with the New Japan product. So here's a guy coming in who isn't even that well-versed in the different wrestlers and the different backgrounds and everything. And I think he's great. I think they make for a great team. For Okada, let me say something about this guy. I cannot think of another wrestler that I've ever seen who has put on the string of quality matches one after the other after the other the way that Okada has this year. Ever since that January 4th match, the first match with Omega, the run that he is on right now is unlike anything that I've ever seen. All three matches with Okada, or Omega, I should say. His matches with Michael Elgin, his match with Suzuki, Shibata, who I'm going to talk about in a little bit, Sonata, Evil, Cody, you know, even that match they had in Long Beach, which maybe of all the ones I just mentioned was the weakest, but by no means a bad match. I mean, I know there's others I'm missing. This doesn't even include the matches that this guy has had, like, in past years with, obviously, Tanahashi. I mean, the classic series of matches that they've had. Ishii, AJ Styles, I think it was at that Dominion show, what was it, a couple years ago? They had an incredible match. One of the best finishing sequences still to a match I've ever seen with Okada and Styles. The guy's only 30 years old. He hasn't even technically hit his prime yet. But he'll be in the discussion for greatest of all time when all is said and done. And greatest of all time is a subjective thing, obviously. Everybody has their own list. And I think everybody's list has a lot to do with who they grew up on. So if you're an older fan, if let's say you're in your mid-40s, you're 50-ish, and you grew up watching those guys in the early to mid-70s, and Bruno and Graham, and maybe, you know, guys in other territories too, not just WWE, your perspective may be different because you grew up with these larger-than-life guys. I mean, I can imagine having, you know, if someone grew up watching nothing but Bruno Sammartino at the Garden every month, the guy was like a god, right? So everybody is sort of a little biased, I think, in that way. Everybody has their own list. But, I mean, just looking at this objectively, I don't know how this guy is not in the conversation. I really don't. I mean, and there's so many great performers, not just in Japan, but, you know, in the U.S. and all over the world. I would say, you know, this guy could very well end up top 15 of all time. Maybe even top 10. I think that's fair. The run he's on, if he could stay healthy enough and have another 5-10 years of matches like this and have a run like this, mostly on top, how is he not top 10 or top 15 of all time when all is said and done? Even business-wise, New Japan's been riding a nice little wave with him on top. Business is good. You know, I'm reading about attendance and whatnot at the different G1s. Apparently, this business-wise may be the best G1 they've ever done out of the 27 that they've had. He's a big part of the resurgence that this company has had in the last several years. And Kenny Omega isn't very far behind. You look at the year Omega's had, the performances that he's churned out since that January 4th match against Okada in the Tokyo Dome. What he did here just in the last 48 hours to go back to back with matches like the one he had with Okada and the one this morning with Naito is unreal. Now, granted, he probably shaved a good 5 years off his career in this tournament. I'm sure a lot of these guys did, getting dropped on their head all those times. But to go back to back like that with two match of the year candidates is very impressive. And for all the crap that Omega gets from the Jim Cornettes of the world and people who look at the matches with blow-up dolls and nine-year-old girls, and even the crap with Yano here in the G1, which I wasn't a fan of him, you know, hopping around with his legs tied up like a bunny rabbit in a tournament where he's having these serious, you know, classic matches. I wasn't a fan of that either. But for all the comedy stuff that he does, you know, when the guy is in there in a situation where it matters and he has to be serious and he has to go in there and you know, be a top guy, he delivers every single time. I think it's going to be a dogfight for Wrestler of the Year when we get to the end of 2017 between him and Okada. It's going to be hard to choose. I mean, me, I'd go with Okada right now, but, you know, New Japan is very lucky to have both of these guys under contract at the same time. Now, it was Omega and Naito in the G1 finals this morning. These two wrestled in the B-Block final in last year's G1, so they're very familiar with each other. Omega won that. He went on to win the entire thing. Naito won the G1 also back in 2013, so we were guaranteed here in this match going into this to have a two-time winner no matter what. You know, what can I say about this match? I just got done watching it. I don't have a lot in the way of bullets that I jotted down here. It's a miracle somebody didn't die with all the blows to the head and all the dropping him on his neck and all this stuff. Early in the match, Naito gave Omega a pile driver onto a table, but he missed most of the table, and Omega hit the edge of the table, which looked absolutely horrifying. Somehow he didn't get cut open or worse, so that was scary, and that was in the first 5 minutes of the match. Some of the V-triggers that Omega hit in this match were just absolutely brutal. There was one they showed in slow-mo that looked like it connected a little too well. Naito was bleeding a little bit from the mouth after that. It took three Destinos to do it, but Naito finally pinned Omega to win his second G1 trophy. So Naito is your winner. One thing I noticed is how protected Omega's one-winged angel is. He went for it about three or four different times in this match. He never hit it. Every time Naito slipped out. So Naito never had a chance to kick out of the move because Omega never did hit it. But in the match with Okada, they'd been building that up for months. He's got to hit that move. And, you know, if he hits it, it's gonna be over. And it was. He hits the move once and he won with it. So for all the Rainmakers and the Destinos and everything else these guys throw at each other, all the V-triggers Omega throws, too many of them, Kenny Omega's finish may be the most protected finish right now in all of wrestling. After the win, Naito, it was funny, they had Masahiro Chono was there who I think the significance of him being there, I think they said, was that he has the most wins in G1 history, if I'm not mistaken. He was there to present the trophy to Naito. Naito teased throwing the trophy out into the crowd, which gave The announcer's quite the scare. You know, when Naito was the Intercontinental Champion, he would toss that belt around like a piece of garbage. I mean, go find a picture of what that belt looked like before I think Tanahashi won it. It looked like, I mean, you think the hardcore title looked bad back in the day, which it did. This IC title on the white strap, no less, it was all dirty. Like, Naito just treated that thing like garbage. Tanahashi actually paid himself with his own money to have that belt sort of refurbished. I mean, he's got a new belt now that he's using, but he's still paid to have the old one fixed up. I kind of think that's a shame. I think he should have left it that way. I think you could have put that in like a museum or a Hall of Fame one day. But because of that, because he used to throw that belt around like it was a piece of garbage, I kind of half expected him to take that trophy and toss it into the fifth row. Chono was there, like I said, to present it to him. He did the Los Ingobernables hand salute with Naito. Naito did the hand salute with Daryl as well. Yes, Daryl lives. The cat is back. It is a miracle. He is recovering from his gruesome injuries at the hands of Bad Luck Fale. I've never seen a human being or an animal recover from a disembowelment before, but somehow Daryl looks pretty good. So it's going to be Naito and Okada for the title at the Tokyo Dome January 4th, provided he doesn't lose that opportunity between now and then. The way it works in New Japan, it's you know, different than the whole Money in the Bank thing in that Naito is going to put his shot on the line probably at least once, if not a few times, and could very well lose it. It may be somebody else going on to face Okada. I don't think that's going to happen, but it is possible. Now, Omega and Okada, or Omega and Ibushi, I should say, had a little run-in backstage when the match was over. I heard about this. Nothing tense, just a little interaction between two friends as Omega came back, you know, through the curtain. Hopefully an early tease of something at Wrestle Kingdom, perhaps a U.S. title match. Although there is, I guess there is the possibility, you know, Ibushi and Tanahashi could have a match for the Intercontinental title, which I'm sure would be fantastic, but me personally, I would love to see Ibushi and Omega. One last thing. I skipped right to the Omega Naito match when I woke up this morning because I had to start recording the podcast. I didn't want to start too late. So I didn't see the rest of the show, but I did see the return of Katsuyori Shibata. Shibata returned. I saw the YouTube clip. It's like a 30 or 40 second clip somebody uploaded to YouTube of him coming to the ring. He walked to the ring. He took a bump on the mat. I'm sure he's been dying to do that. He had tears in his eyes. He looked good considering all the scary things that have been written about him and that he himself has blogged about, his vision and everything else. I mean, the guy had brain surgery, multiple brain surgeries for crying out loud. All things considered, he looked pretty good. The fact that he could just walk to the ring and take any bumps, I think, is a good sign. But the best part about this appearance, so he comes out, he grabs the microphone, and I couldn't understand what he said, but apparently, all he said, because he spoke very quickly and dropped the mic and left. So I'm like, I wonder what he said. Apparently what he said was, "I'm alive, that is all." A man of few words, Shibata. "I'm alive, that is all." Doesn't tell us a whole lot about his current condition. But like I said, just the fact that he could walk out to the ring, you know, on his own and you know, cut a 10-second promo and take a bump, to me that's a good sign. I don't know if he is ever going to wrestle again. I don't know that he should ever wrestle again. But that was a cool moment. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Bizarro World, which according to WWE is, in fact, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Raw Twitter poll, over 2,000 votes, 54% thumbs up, 46% thumbs down, so almost an even split, which probably isn't all that great. First of all, quick injury update here. It's the walking wounded right now in WWE. I'm sure it's the walking wounded in New Japan right now, too. Bayley did in fact separate her shoulder in that match with Nia Jax a couple of weeks ago. She is out of SummerSlam. We'll talk more about Bayley in a second because I have some thoughts on her. Scott Dawson of the Revival suffered a ruptured bicep. And it looks like, I don't know that it's official, but it looks like the Revival is likely out of SummerSlam. And if he has surgery, then he could be out for a long, long time. He could be out for a good 6 months. I don't know if he's having surgery. I don't know if it's the sort of thing he can just rehab on his own, tape it up, and just they'll let him wrestle. We don't know yet. But he is likely out of SummerSlam. Paige. Paige is not a name that has been mentioned very often as far as WWE goes, and some people probably thought, well, she'll never even wrestle there again. I never really bought into that, and it sounds like she may be on her way back a lot sooner than people think. She tweeted that she was having, I think, a final examination or something. Remember, she had neck surgery many months ago. My understanding is that she has been cleared, or it seems anyway that she may have been cleared. She tweeted something very vague. It was like a happy dance gif that certainly made you think that she got positive news this past week. And the only positive news I could think of is that, well, maybe she got her release right now, but she'd probably be pretty happy about that. No, I mean, it looks like she may be on her way back soon. And say what you want to about Paige and all the crap that she's been involved in, but if they get her back and she's healthy, she, you know, can really help, I think, shake things up a little bit in that Raw division. They get her back, she's a big star. She'd be one of the biggest stars in that entire division. To get her back to have matches with Sasha and, you know, and people like that, I think would be good. It would be good for the Raw brand, so I'm kind of hoping she does make her way back. So, what were the highlights of this show? Well, anytime Brock Lesnar destroys a bunch of dudes, I don't care what anybody says, that's always fun to watch. I don't care who it is. In this case, it was The Miz and his entourage. Brock was on Miz TV. Things did not end well the last time Brock was on Miz TV. Or maybe it was Heyman who was on Miz TV, but Brock came out, and Brock, I remember, threw a chair at The Miz's head. He flipped over a sofa. This time, Heyman asked Miz if he and Maurice ever role play, because Brock was about to do a little role playing himself, which made me throw up in my mouth a little bit. Just the mere thought of that is enough to give me nightmares. Heyman said they were going to pretend that each member of the Miztourage was one of Brock's opponents at SummerSlam in the Fatal 4-Way. And Lesnar proceeded to suplex and F5 every single one of them into oblivion. He left bodies strewn all over. They were in Toronto. Brock, as far as I know, Brock still lives up in Canada. He's up in the, you know, in the woods somewhere. I don't know if it's in Saskatchewan or where he lives. But he's a Canadian boy. In fact, I think one of the last fights he had in UFC, I think he came out with a Canadian flag. So, of course, he was treated like a total babyface there. Seth Rollins lost to Sheamus after the distraction by Cesaro. They laid out Rollins after the match. People were waiting for Dean Ambrose to come out to make the save, but he never did. Later in the show, Ambrose had a match with Cesaro. Turned into a damn good match, too. They got almost 20 minutes out there. When the match was over, Sheamus and Cesaro were beating down Ambrose, and Seth Rollins did make the save. Ambrose and Rollins had a long stare down. Crowd was buzzing. They wanted them so badly to do the old Shield fist bump. Now, remember, Ambrose has been the one who's been very reluctant to put his fist out because it was Rollins who turned his back on it. I mean, Rollins was really the one who caused the whole split with the Shield in the first place. But apparently, Ambrose, after all these weeks and Rollins coming out now and helping him, he's having second thoughts, and finally he puts his fist out. Crowd goes crazy. But this time it was Seth Rollins' turn to say no, and he walked away. He was obviously very upset that Ambrose did not come out earlier in the show to help him. So screw you, I'm not going to give you a fist bump. And Rollins walked to the back and the fans booed. I will say that I have been enjoying the slow build here for this eventual Shield reunion, whether it's a reunion of two or a reunion of all three, that I don't know. It could very well just be a reunion of the two, by the way. But I've been enjoying the slow build. Obviously, I expect them to challenge Sheamus and Cesaro for the tag team titles at SummerSlam, even though they haven't really announced that yet. They haven't made the match official. You know it's coming tomorrow night, though. But they've done well with this story. And when they finally do the big fist bump, which may well be tomorrow night, people are going to lose their minds. Jason Jordan. Jason Jordan was supposed to wrestle Curtis Axel here on this show. But after Axel was slaughtered in the open by Brock Lesnar, Axel could not compete. Now, if you remember on the podcast last week, in pitching ideas on how WWE could slowly build to a Jason Jordan Miz match instead of just putting it out there at SummerSlam, which right now they're not doing, it has not been announced, they may not do that match at SummerSlam. I hope they don't, because I think that you need to build to it a little bit more. But in pitching ideas for this, I suggested, well, Jordan should at the very least have individual matches at first with Bo Dallas and have a match with Curtis Axel on his way to The Miz, right? The Miz should put those guys out there and say, well, you got to get through my entourage first before you get to me. I also suggested if you need to kill time between now and the next Raw pay-per-view, because you got to, I don't know how many weeks between now and then, it's probably a good, I don't know, between SummerSlam and No Mercy, it's probably every bit of four or five weeks. You got to fill time somehow. I suggested you can have a match or two on TV with Jordan up against some random job guy. Just put him out there, let him showcase his moves, his suplexes. That's what's going to get this guy over. Well, on this show, we technically got both things that I suggested, right? We got Jordan against Axel announced, even though it never happened, and we ended up getting Jordan against the jobber here on this show. Kurt Angle, what happened here is Kurt Angle spotted a random guy walking around backstage named Jean-Pierre Goulet, Jean-Pierre Goulet, which is some weird amalgamation of different wrestlers from over the years. Jean-Pierre Lafitte and René Goulet, they do this all the time. It's like, remember Kenny Dykstra? Hey, this guy, somebody on the writing team's a Mets fan, really likes, or maybe a Phillies fan, really likes Lenny Dykstra. So we'll call this name Kenny Dykstra. We'll call this guy Kenny Dykstra. That's how they come up with these things. So he's a local Canadian talent. Kurt sees him. He says, I need you to go out to the ring. The only thing I did not expect from this, so while I pitched those ideas and I wasn't shocked to see them, I was shocked to see them do it in one night. But what I did not expect was that the jobber they used would be billed in Canada as being from Canada, which of course got him cheered and got Jason Jordan booed. That was a boneheaded decision on their part. And I don't want to hear from people, oh, Solomonster, they meant to do that. They're turning him heel, can't you see? Look, he may well end up being a heel. I think the plan to go with in the long term, yeah, is to turn this guy heel. Maybe 3 months from now he's a heel. Maybe 6 months from now he's a heel. I still think the match at WrestleMania is going to be Kurt Angle against Jason Jordan. So yeah, I don't doubt that it's coming at some point. But I don't buy for a second that that was part of their strategy here. We got a long-term plan. Let's debut this guy as Kurt's son and immediately we'll turn him heel. I don't buy that. I think it's backfiring on them. I think that they made some stupid decisions and their hand may be forced to go in that direction a little bit quicker than they would have liked. But I don't buy that for a second. Well, this is all part of the heel turn. I saw a note on one of the episodes, I guess, of Observer Live this week. I guess Brian Alvarez mentioned that people behind the scenes actually thought the crowd would hate the jobber because he was from Quebec. And I guess people from Quebec don't like people from Toronto and vice versa. If this is the kind of logic we're dealing with here, then Jordan is doomed. This guy doesn't stand a chance. Fact is, this all could have been avoided had they just gone with Chad Gable as Kurt's son like they should have done. Right from the get-go. And they still can. I mean, look, in the, you know, they could do a big swerve months from now that reveals Gable was really the son. And then they could do a Jordan Gable feud. But honestly, at this point, I'm not even sure you have to do that. I mean, it's a dumb storyline. We can all agree. Even if they can salvage this thing somehow, it's a dumb storyline, okay? Gable, he's already having good matches on SmackDown. He's kind of building some momentum a little bit on SmackDown as himself. I know. A wrestler getting himself over on his own merits. What kind of black magic is this? I know, right? What a concept. So I don't even think that Gable needs that, to be perfectly honest with you. I almost don't, in a way, want him to kind of be soiled by this. But let's see where things go. I mean, the guy has been Kurt's son for like 3 weeks. Right? Maybe a month. I don't even know if it's been that long. I still think you got to give it some time, but they didn't do Jordan any favors on this show. I want to talk about Bayley after what happened here on Raw. I mentioned earlier that she suffered a separated shoulder in that match with Nia Jax. She is off the pay-per-view. She came out for an in-ring promo with Charlie Caruso here in Toronto. And the crowd turned on her. Now, I understand that Bayley is not the best promo. In fact, I think in a lot of ways, she's one of the worst on the show. That's not her strong suit. I will give you that. But she comes out here in a sling. They boo Bayley. Not the first time that a crowd, by the way, has booed her. We've seen this a few other times in the last few months. Only WWE could screw up a character like Bayley, my God, to where she's actually getting booed. You would have told me this a year ago. I'll be honest with you. If you would have told me this a year ago, I probably would believe you. I can't even sit here and say anymore, I wouldn't believe you. Look at who we're dealing with here. Look at who's writing the show. You know what? Yeah, I would believe you. If you would have told me that a year ago, I'd say, yep, that sounds about right. But this crowd here, they booed Bayley. They did this after having just seen highlights of her having been legitimately injured the week before. Clearly, she was flustered. This caught her off guard. She wasn't expecting this. She didn't really know how to react. She said, I don't know who's booing. I'm thanking all my fans, the ones who aren't booing. Now, that may not have been the smartest thing to say in terms of trying to get them to stop booing, because the booing only intensified after she said that. But they were treating her like Roman Reigns out there. I thought it was really distasteful for people to boo her, and I'll tell you why. It's one thing to hate the way that she's been booked. It's one way to not even like her. I like Bayley. If you don't, that's cool. Some people don't get the character. They think it's lame. They think it's childish, which is kind of the point. I get that. That's fine if you don't like Bayley. But it's one thing to hate the way, if you are a Bayley fan, that she's been booked. But she's out there in a sling a week after separating her shoulder. She looks like her dog died, okay? She's so depressed, I'm sure, about being pulled from this pay-per-view. You know, it's like there's a time and a place. This wasn't it. This wasn't it. Now, maybe they thought the injury was phony. I mean, I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt here, right? The Canadian crowd, more often than not, is a lot of fun to watch. They add an energy to the show that usually the show lacks. I don't want to hate on the Toronto crowd. But the booing here in this situation, I just thought was wrong. I didn't agree with it. And I felt bad for her. I felt bad for her coming out in a sling, down in the dumps like that, and then getting shit on for it. They had two triple threat matches in light of her injury here on the show to determine a number one contender for Alexa Bliss at SummerSlam. We had Sasha Banks winning one of the triple threat matches, beating Emma, of course. And Alicia Fox, she made Emma tap out to the bank statement. In the other match, Nia Jax beat Dana Brooke and Mickie James, which means that it's going to be Sasha against Nia this Monday night, tomorrow night, on Raw. Sasha should win. There's no way she doesn't make it onto the SummerSlam card now that Bayley is off. She'll be on there one way or the other. They could do something, I suppose, maybe have like a non-finish tomorrow night, and it turns into a triple threat with Nia involved. It would kind of make sense because Nia and Alexa have had this sort of on-again, off-again alliance for weeks now. I mean, I hate to say it because I really would rather it just be one-on-one, but if they did a triple threat, it would kind of make sense. That being said, I don't want to see it. I want to see Sasha one-on-one against Alexa. I'm not giving up the ghost here on this idea of them doing a false count anywhere match, even though I'm sure it's not happening. But that really is the match that I would like to see. And that's the match I think that should happen. That's probably the most marketable women's match they could do, honestly, on this show. Roman Reigns and Braun Strowman had a last man standing match. I like this match a lot. These two have great chemistry together. They had another really fun match, despite a completely stupid finish, which I'll get to here in a second. Easily, without hesitation, the spot of the match, the spot of the night, belonged to Braun Strowman, who, at one point, finds himself outside the ring over by the barricade. Roman Reigns is preparing for a spear. He is readying himself to charge in to spear Braun Strowman here out on the floor. And as Roman comes running in, Strowman, and this was like off camera, so this thing came into camera view from like outer space, okay? Strowman hurls, and I mean hurls, one of the announce chairs. So this wasn't like a metal folding chair. I mean, you could say the metal folding chair would have been worse, but the visual of this I thought was so perfect. It wasn't one of the metal folding chairs. This was one of those large padded chairs that you see at the announce desk. So yes, it is padded, but it's huge. This thing is gigantic. It weighs a ton. Strowman launches this thing right at Roman's face, and it connected perfectly. The way they shot it, the way Roman sold it, it connected perfectly. He sold this like he had been shot. This was like a scene out of JFK. Back and to the left. Roman falls to the floor like he's dead. Michael Cole is having an orgasm on commentary when he saw this. I apologize to people who may be eating listening to this. Wasn't good enough to win the match. Reigns still got up before the count of 10. They ended up brawling up the ramp over by the announce desk. Strowman threatened to powerbomb Roman through the announce table, but Roman fought back. Reigns sprinted down the ramp. He spears Strowman. That looked to be it for Braun. He's down. He's not getting up. Referee's count was up to about 8 or 9, I think, or maybe 7 or 8, when all of a sudden Samoa Joe, I guess sitting in the front row, reaches over. I didn't even notice him there. He reaches over. He locks Reigns in the Coquina clutch. Now, mind you, the referee was still counting Strowman. Strowman is still down. For some reason, the referee sees this. He stops counting. Joe puts Reigns out with the choke. Referee starts his count all over again. This allows Strowman to make it back up to his feet before the count of 10, and Braun Strowman wins the last man standing match. I love the bit with Joe because I didn't see it coming, but boy, was that stupid, having the referee stop his count on Strowman. It's a no disqualification match. What the hell is he stopping the count for? So that I thought that was dumb, but the right man won. I think the thing I love about this is everybody has been made in this Fatal 4-Way. Everybody has been made to look strong going into SummerSlam, which is another reason why I'm looking forward to that match so much. Brock is Brock, right? He destroyed Miz and his band of merry men here at the beginning of the show. Roman pinned Joe in that triple threat match the week before, which I know pissed a lot of people off, but, you know, that was a big win for Roman Reigns. Strowman got a win here in a last man standing match, and Joe choked out Reigns to avenge his loss from the week before. And actually, they went off the air even more than Strowman standing tall. They went off the air with Samoa Joe, you know, walking to the back like some big badass. So everybody looks strong going into a match that conceivably anybody can win. That, I think, is what makes the SummerSlam main event such a winner and why so many people are looking forward to that match. They've done a really good job of building it up. Which brings me to SmackDown. SmackDown was back in Toronto the next night. You guys voted on Twitter, all 1,600 of you, 65% thumbs up, 35% thumbs down. John Cena and Baron Corbin is official for SummerSlam. They did dueling promos to start the show. Cena called Corbin a skinny, fat dumpster fire. Daniel Bryan came out and made the match official. I have not heard somebody called skinny, fat since Triple H called CM Punk a skinny, fat ass during their feud. Corbin has new music, by the way. I am not sold on it. Perhaps over time it will grow on me. I thought his music before was perfect for his entrance, but I guess they felt differently. The latest Fashion Peaks segment had Tyler Breeze interviewing The Ascension about the dream that he had in last week's segment. You know, remember the one where Connor was pouring maple syrup on that log, which you didn't see it, but was then promptly devoured by Kevin Dunn. They didn't really have any answers for Tyler Breeze about where Fandango was, or Dango, as Breeze calls him. Suddenly, Fandango reappears, just like that. He's back. This great mystery of what happened to him when he was dragged off at the last pay-per-view. Here he is, back in the flesh. He claims he was kidnapped by aliens, and that he could have left any time he wanted to, but he opted to stay for the anal probes. And I'm sure Vince McMahon gave himself a hernia laughing so hard. He then corrected himself and said, oh, I didn't mean anal probes. I meant wardrobes. Of course, naturally he did. He said the aliens tried to give him the ability to see the future. I wish the aliens would give this the creative team the ability to see things long term. So he said the aliens tried to give him the ability to see the future. He predicted that the next person to walk in that door was the one who beheaded their beloved horse, Tully. Remember the stuffed animal, the horse, Tully, was decapitated? All of a sudden, the door swings open, and in walks Arn Anderson. He confessed to murdering Tully, he grabbed two donuts, and he walked out. Having Arn Anderson as the person who killed Tully was very clever. I will give them that. I did not see that coming. I hope this leads to a Brainbusters return at SummerSlam against Breezango. right? You watch this, you think, man, this is building to a match here. We're going to get Tully Blanchard back. He'll team with Arn Anderson. I don't doubt, by the way, that those two could probably still have a decent match if they wanted to. Who knows? Maybe they are. Maybe they're the mystery team that's been trashing Breezango's office all these weeks. By the way, gratuitous plug, you can go back and listen to my interview with Arn and Tully on Sound Off 212. I never thought I'd be sitting across from two of the Four Horsemen for an interview, but life is funny that way. I like the segment with Shane McMahon, Kevin Owens, and AJ Styles. I especially enjoyed Owens showing footage of Shane screwing over Stone Cold Steve Austin in his match with Mankind in the Deadly Game tournament at Survivor Series 20 years ago. I think that was the match where Foley's pants fell down when Austin stunned him. But that's some storyline continuity there, trying to show that Shane cannot be trusted. It's like that video they put together when Shawn Michaels super-kicked Hulk Hogan on Raw. Remember that? He kicked him in the face, and to build to their match at SummerSlam, they put this great video package together of highlights. It was all highlights of the different people that Shawn Michaels has screwed over. All the, of course, Bret Hart was left out of the video, but all the people that Shawn Michaels has turned on over the years. It showed him throwing Jannetty through the barbershop window and hitting X-Pac in the head with a chair when he was the commissioner. I like stuff like that. I like it when they actually acknowledge their past and they don't just ignore it. I still, you know, to this, I know I'm getting off track here, but to this day, I still cannot believe in all of the build-up to my favorite WrestleMania match of all time. WrestleMania 25, Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker. They never once mentioned that it, and I pitched this on the podcast. I was like, this is what they need to do. This is how they need to build this match up. They never once mentioned that it was The Undertaker who backdropped Shawn onto that casket at the Royal Rumble. That was the injury that took 4 years away from this guy's career. It just seemed like such a natural hook for the match. I mean, it didn't need it, I guess, because they were just two big stars, right? That's all it is. It's two big stars, and Shawn just wants to end the streak. So that's all you need. But it would have added a little something. Would have added something more personal to it, right? You would never even know these two had a history together if you were a newer fan. But that would have been the story if I, you know, would have looked at this and said, okay, how should we do this? Well, Shawn is looking for revenge, and he's going to break the streak. He's going to end the Undertaker streak and get his revenge for what he did to him all those years ago. Anyway, Owens also pointed out that Shane and AJ have had a history together, right? In fact, they had a match at WrestleMania just this year. AJ beat Shane McMahon back at WrestleMania 33. So Owens attacked Styles. Styles went for the Pele kick. He nailed Shane with it by accident. And I thought this was a good segment. Carmella pinned Naomi in a non-title match when James Ellsworth returned from his suspension to shove Naomi off the top rope. It was more like Naomi threw herself off the top rope because she jumped before Ellsworth could even touch her. That allowed Carmella to nail a super kick and get the pin. You would think that Daniel Bryan would fire James Ellsworth after suspending him for a month. And then in his very first match back, he interferes to help Carmella, but Bryan did nothing of the sort. Speaking of Ellsworth, he wins for Savage Tweet of the Week for his Twitter reply to Becky Lynch. They've been trading barbs now the last few weeks on Twitter, and Becky said, Ellsworth is back. Someone call a spaceship to come pick him up. Which is kind of lame, not going to lie. In response, Ellsworth said, oh, how cute. You must have been born on a highway because that's where most accidents happen. Well, then, I'm no fan of man-on-woman violence in wrestling, but that was just a straight-up beatdown right there. That was awesome. I will give Ellsworth credit for that one. That was much better than Becky Lynch's lame joke. Shinsuke Nakamura did a sit-down interview with Renee Young. He said at SummerSlam, the Nakamura dynasty begins. And, you know, we can quibble with, you know, the little detours that they take to get from point A to point B. But let's look at Nakamura's run on the main roster so far, okay? The guy only debuted in April. He debuted after WrestleMania. We're not even 6 months into his run on TV. He had a pretty epic debut on TV with the violinist, remember that? He pinned John Cena clean on TV just the other week. And now here he is wrestling for the WWE title in one of the main events anyway, at SummerSlam. You know what? I'd call that a pretty successful run so far. And then there was the main event of Randy Orton against Jinder Mahal. For the love of God, make it stop. Orton won clean with the RKO. This was a non-title match. Which in theory, I hate to say this, but in theory, should earn Orton another crack at the championship. He beat the champion. He pinned the champion on television. Right? Theoretically, if this was done the correct way, Orton would be next in line now for a championship match. Now, I'll boycott this show if that happens. But yet, that's exactly what I hate. Champs are chumps. Remember that whole thing? Champs are chumps. And they got better with it. You haven't heard me mention that in a while. But there's a reason I have two t-shirts up in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees that say champs are chumps. There was a point in time where this was the norm. Every week. Sometimes multiple champions on the same show even would be pinned. And only in a few select cases would it even lead to a match for the championship with the person who beat them. I mean, again, it's fine if it leads to a title shot for that person, but in this case, that's the last thing I want to see. But yeah, I watched this and I thought to myself, why? Why was it necessary to have Orton pin this guy clean in the middle after he put him over three straight pay-per-view matches? There was nothing else Randy Orton could do. He went in there for three straight pay-per-views, and every single time Jinder Mahal came out on top. Now, whether Jinder Mahal is a main eventer in the eyes of most fans or people still can't accept him, you know, if you're Randy Orton, you go in there and he did everything he could to help get the guy over as a serious threat. He could have gone in there and said, I'm going to lose to this guy three times in a row. The hell with that, right? He's got enough stock. He's been there long enough where he could do that if he wanted to, but he didn't. It's like when he put over Mark Henry all those years ago. He lost to him on two straight pay-per-views. Mark Henry was doing nothing. All of a sudden, boom, out of nowhere, he's on this Hall of Pain run. He's got the world title. I love that run, by the way. May not have happened if Randy Orton didn't just eat the finish and get pinned two pay-per-views in a row. Here he is again doing the same thing for Jinder Mahal. I'll give him credit for that. So why then, this is what I don't understand. Why do you squander that? Why do you have this meaningless match that isn't going to lead to anything and just have Randy Orton pin him in the middle 1-2-3? It just makes no sense. I think that was also Jinder's first loss since he won the championship. He had been on this run where he had not lost. Can't say that anymore. But the feud is over. I hope it is. The feud is over. I don't understand why they did this. Then, literally, the last, I'd say, 3 seconds of the show, as they're fading to black, Rusev comes out from the back, he kicks Orton in the face, and that was it. They quickly faded out, and the show is over. So, in my mind, you know, there's no way that Orton loses to Rusev at the pay-per-view, because for the very reason I just mentioned. When was the last time Randy Orton even won a pay-per-view match? You'd have to go all the way back to WrestleMania. I think he's overdue for a win. I expect him to win. You know, why did he have to beat Jinder here on this show? I fully expected a Rusev run-in. Yeah, you would have groaned, interference. But it would have made sense, right? Orton's on the precipice of victory, and out comes Rusev. It's just very weird what they did here on this show. I don't get why they had to do that to Jinder. Main event aside, I did think the show was solid, so that was SmackDown. Now, SummerSlam 2017 is coming from the Barclays Center 1 week from today. 6 hours. That is how long SummerSlam is this year if you count the two-hour kickoff show that starts at 5 Eastern. These things just get longer and longer and longer. The card, honestly, kind of disappointing. Aside from the main event, I can't say there's any match that really jumps out at me that makes me say, man, I can't wait to see that match. Now, maybe they'll do something on TV this week. I am doing these predictions a little early. The go-home shows haven't happened yet. Who knows, right? Who knows what may happen? Maybe we'll get Sasha and Alexa. That'd be a fun match. But, aside from that main event, there isn't much really hooking me into this show. The other thing is, they want this show to be the WrestleMania of the summer, right? They're making this thing as long as WrestleMania. Hopefully it doesn't go off the air after midnight, like WrestleMania did this year. And yet, we are a week out, and we still don't know a lot of the matches on this show. For all the matches that they have announced, there's a lot of uncertainty about this card. We assume it's going to be Rollins and Ambrose against Sheamus and Cesaro for the Raw Tag Team titles, but nothing's been made official. The Hardys have no match. Scott Dawson is hurt. There's a very good chance the Revival is off the show. So we can only assume that if they put the Hardys on the show, it'll be against the Club. I don't know who else it would be against. Miz and Jason Jordan, that could still get added. I don't see any reason to do it so soon. But that could be added. You got people like Sami Zayn not on the show. Charlotte doesn't even have a match on the card. Again, this could all change on TV this week, but they've already got 11 matches confirmed. Plus Goldust said on Monday, remember that? I'm unveiling my latest masterpiece, or he's going to be watching SummerSlam very intently. I don't know if that maybe is a tease for him starting to get like a protege or something along those lines. But yet there's all this uncertainty about the card, even with all the matches that have been announced. That's a little weird. I don't think you would do that if this were WrestleMania. That being said, I am looking forward to the Fatal 4-Way a lot. Anybody conceivably could win this thing, even though I think they tipped their hat when they added that stipulation that if Brock loses, him and Heyman are gone from WWE. We'll get to that. Let's start from the bottom here. I don't know yet which matches are going to end up on the kickoff show. We'll find out probably tomorrow night. I know one that should, and that is Big Cass against The Big Show, with Enzo Amore above the ring in a shark cage. Normally, you would put the heel in the shark cage, so this is a little ass backwards here, although I guess to a lot of people in that company these days, Enzo probably is the heel, and they probably would love nothing more than to just lock him in a shark cage and leave him up there if all the stories are true. We have the shark cage. Why do you think we have the shark cage here? Because they have toys to sell. They came out with a shark cage playset last year. This is our third match in the last 12 months to use the shark cage. If you don't think that has something to do with selling toys, you're out of your mind. That's the only reason we're getting this stipulation. Third time in the last year that they're doing the shark cage. When was the last time in WWE before this that we saw the shark cage used? You'd have to go back years and years. Now we have three in 1 year. Remember, Paul Ellering was up in the cage at NXT TakeOver last November in Toronto. 2 months after that, Royal Rumble, Chris Jericho, up in the cage during Kevin Owens' match with Roman Reigns. And now here's number three. I'm going with Cass because, to me, this whole thing is designed to help get him over. Big Show's been punching him in the face and knocking him out left and right on TV. I don't see what is gained by having Big Show win this match. I'm sure Enzo will probably do something that, you know, costs Big Show the match. He'll drop something down and Cass will catch it or something. But I think Big Cass goes over here. I think he should go over. We have Neville defending the Cruiserweight title against Akira Tozawa. I'm going to surprise some people, I think, here. I'm going to go with Tozawa. I think Tozawa wins the Cruiserweight title. I think Neville has had a great, great run with that championship this year. I don't doubt that he'll get the title back, you know, if he loses it. But he's been champion now since the Royal Rumble. And nobody has been able to get the better of this guy. Not even Austin Aries, for all the matches they had, could not get the better of Neville. It just seems like there's no real legitimate competition for this guy. Tozawa, he's pretty popular, I think. And they've been investing a lot of TV time in him with the whole Titus brand. He's got a great finish. It's a great finisher. The leaping senton off the top. I just think it's time that somebody beats Neville and just shakes things up a little bit in that division. If it were me, I would have done Neville and Cedric Alexander on this show. That would have been the match. But it's about time that I think somebody takes that title off of Neville and makes things a little more interesting. And Tozawa would be a fine choice, so he's my pick to win it. New Day against the Usos for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. The Usos, they never should have lost those titles in the first place. They are doing the best work of their career right now on SmackDown, in the ring and on the mic. It's better to have the New Day chase them for the titles, so I think Usos should win. I think they will win. They are my pick. Then we have Finn Balor against Bray Wyatt. Balor did an interview with IGN where he threw cold water on the idea that we might see the Demon resurrected at SummerSlam. We have not seen him in the Demon paint since last year's SummerSlam when he got injured in the match with Seth Rollins. This is what he said to IGN. He said, you know, the Demon only comes out in certain special situations, and I don't think my match at SummerSlam against Bray Wyatt calls for it necessarily. I think I'm perfectly capable of handling that on my own as Finn Balor. The demon is something I have to personally tap into and believe in, and the opportunity has not arose, and the situation has not presented itself yet. The story hasn't required it. Now, he could very easily be swerving all of us, but if he is not, what the hell does that tell you about the state of Bray Wyatt right now? My match against Bray Wyatt is nothing special. I think I can handle this on my own. Holy shit. I read that. I laughed my ass off. I'm like, man, holy crap. But, you know, look, demon or no demon, I'm picking Balor. Balor is my pick. It's tough making these picks before the go-home show. Normally, I would wait, but I just don't want to leave this for the last minute. There's going to be a lot going on next weekend. I may not get these predictions up until like an hour before the pay-per-view because it's starting so freaking early. So that's why I'm doing them now. But it's hard to do predictions before the go-home shows air. I kind of like it, though. It's kind of more of a challenge to go back and see if I got them right. Especially when you realize they probably don't even know who's winning half these matches yet. I'm making predictions on matches that don't even have winners yet. But I'm picking Balor. Naomi defends her SmackDown Women's title against Natalya. Not the strongest women's match, I think, for the championship that they could have done here on this show. But I think that has to do with the fact that Carmella is cashing in. The only question is, does she cash in on Natalya or does she cash in on Naomi? Does Naomi retain first and then she cashes in? I say Naomi wins. I think she'll beat Natalya, and then Carmella cashes in, but the inevitable assist from Ellsworth backfires, and Naomi retains. Carmella fails to cash in successfully. That's my prediction here. I just feel like Carmella beat her once already on TV. She beat her this past week. There's no law that says that she can't beat her again, but I just don't see it happening. I think that she's going to cash in. I think she's going to fail. Randy Orton against Rusev. I'm going with Orton. Like I said before, he has lost every single one of his pay-per-view matches, going back to Payback in April, including three straight losses to Jinder Mahal. This guy is due for a win. It's just unfortunate that it's going to come at the expense of Rusev, who just got beat by John Cena, but such is life. Speaking of John Cena, he faces Mr. Money in the Bank himself, Baron Corbin. I've had a change of heart here. I thought Cena was going to win so that Corbin could cash in later in the show and that, you know, I was kind of pitching for Corbin to cash in and fail, but I've been thinking more about this. You're not going to have two failed cash-ins. I think Carmella's more likely to cash in and fail. I no longer think Corbin is cashing in on the show, though. I think Carmella is, but I don't think they're going to do two cash-ins on the same show. I think they're going to want to space them out. Plus, remember, John Cena suffers from what I like to call the Nexus Curse. Cena has yet to win a match at SummerSlam in 6 years since he buried the Nexus back in 2010, which even he admits was a stupid thing to do in hindsight. I mean, I think we all could have said that with foresight, let alone hindsight, but at least he admits it. But ever since he buried the Nexus in 2010, he has lost every single SummerSlam match that he's been in. This would make it 7 straight years. I say the curse continues. It's like 7 years of bad luck that you get from breaking a mirror. I say the streak continues. I say he loses here. I'm picking Baron Corbin. Alexa Bliss defends her Raw Women's Championship against the winner of the Sasha Banks-Nia Jax match on Raw tomorrow night. Could turn into a three-way with no winner tomorrow night. I think Sasha wins that match, though. I think she wins. I think they end up doing the match that they should have done in the first place, which is Sasha versus Alexa. If they do, I think Alexa retains. I really wish they would make this false count anywhere, but I'm not going to hold my breath on that. Either way, Alexa Bliss retaining is my prediction for the match. I think we do get Ambrose and Rollins against Sheamus and Cesaro for the Raw Tag Team titles. I think they'll make it official tomorrow night, and I think Ambrose and Rollins will win the Raw Tag Team titles. AJ Styles against Kevin Owens for the United States Championship. Shane McMahon as the guest referee. There's no way Owens is winning the title here. There's no way. AJ wins. Owens cries foul again when the match is over. He'll blame Shane for his loss, and it will lead to a match at the next SmackDown pay-per-view between Shane McMahon and Kevin Owens. Shinsuke Nakamura and Jinder Mahal for the WWE Championship. I think Nakamura should win the title. I think he will win the title. I'm picking Nakamura here. I think it's time for the Jinder Mahal as WWE Champion experiment to come to an end. He and the Singh brothers can stick together. They could do their thing. Jinder is in a much better position now than he was 6 months ago. Good for him. And look, he's worked hard. I'm not doubting any of that. But Jinder Mahal as WWE champion, it's time to stick a fork in it. And I think we get a Money in the Bank cash-in tease, or maybe even an attempt from Baron Corbin, but maybe, you know, the bell doesn't ring, it's not official. He'll definitely show up in some way, shape, or form, but I don't think he actually cashes in on this show. Because I think a lot of people probably expect it. I think they go in a different direction. I think they save it for another show. And then we have the main event. Brock Lesnar, Samoa Joe, Roman Reigns, and Braun Strowman. In a fatal four-way match for the Universal Championship, Paul Heyman has said that if Brock Lesnar loses the title, he and Lesnar will leave WWE. Obviously, they're playing off all the Jon Jones speculation. Speaking of Jon Jones, somebody asked him on Twitter about showing up in the front row at SummerSlam, and he said, "It's crossed my mind." That's what Jon Jones says. He won't be there. He won't be there. WWE is not inviting him. Per Ryan Satin, I saw him mention, because apparently WWE feels that him being there would distract from the match. Which it would. I mean, in all fairness, if he was sitting in the front row, it would distract from the match. I still think it would be pretty funny, though, if he bought a ticket on his own, and there he is, sitting in the front row. Mind games. It's all about mind games. Now, granted, mind games for a fight that isn't even happening until next summer. But, you know, Jon Jones gonna play the long game here. Long game of mind games. Anyway, Brock's not going anywhere, and I really wish they never would have made that stipulation, because to me, it just gives away the finish. Yes, he could lose, and then he could disappear for a month or two and come back anyway, but not when he's booked for TV after SummerSlam. He is booked for TVs in September, he is booked for the next Raw pay-per-view. It makes no sense for him to lose and then show up again 2 weeks later. So I'm picking Brock Lesnar to retain. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. Not because I want him to. This is a prediction of what I think will happen. If it were up to me, I want Samoa Joe walking out of there with the championship. Samoa Joe would be my ideal pick for a winner. He's the one who should win. But my prediction is that Brock keeps the title. So those are my SummerSlam predictions. If they add any other matches on this week that I did not mention, I'll try to sneak in a prediction or two for them on next week's podcast. I just didn't want to wait to do these until next weekend because that show is starting so early and there's so much going on. I don't know where I'm going to be, if I'm going to any of the shows. I have no tickets for anything right now. I want to at least go to NXT. Maybe I'll go to SummerSlam. I don't know what's happening. So I said, you know what? Best to just do these predictions now and get them out of the way.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week, Eric Young is back. He has not been on NXT television for several weeks. His mother died from cancer back in June, I think, which is why he had taken some time off. Just an awful thing. He joined in as Sanity attacked the Authors of Pain at the start of the show. First time we've really seen AOP take a beatdown like this. It almost felt like the start of maybe a babyface turn for these guys. The Street Profits made their debut. Montez Ford and Angelo Dawkins still doing that god-awful stirring the pot motion with his hands. I want to cut this guy's hands off. The Baker is back on NXT. They faced a new team called the Metro Brothers, who came out in leather jackets looking like Deuce and Domino. I believe Mauro Ranallo mentioned that they were trained by the Dudley Boys at their Team 3D Academy. I can't believe that Bubba Ray would let these guys walk out of their house looking like this. Ford hit a frog splash for the win. He comes to the ring when the Street Profits come out. Montez Ford comes out with a red solo cup in his hand. Guy looks like he's ready to play beer pong. I'm just glad to have a new team on TV. We need some new tag teams. I didn't see enough of them here to say whether they're good, they're bad. I'm just happy to have any new teams here on this show. We need more. We need more tag teams. Hopefully Red Dragon, for example, will be on TV very soon. We had a face-to-face in the ring with Bobby Roode and Drew McIntyre. William Regal was there to make sure things didn't get out of hand. Roode had personal security with him to protect himself from Roderick Strong. Strong did come out in the middle of this promo here. He pulled a Braun Strowman, basically, by telling Roode, "I'm not finished with you." He didn't say it in those exact words, but that's what he meant. He said, "I don't care about the title. I just want to fight Bobby Roode." And Rude said, you know what? Fine. I'll fight you. In fact, I'll even put my NXT championship on the line if you can beat Drew McIntyre next week on NXT. And Regal did not want to make the match at first. McIntyre, he convinced him to do it. He said, you know what? I like that idea. Let's do it. And so this Wednesday, 3 days before TakeOver, it will be Drew McIntyre against Roderick Strong. If Roddy wins, he gets an NXT title match with Rude at some point. It will not. Regal made it very clear. The match at TakeOver is set. It will not be changed. It will not be amended in any way. But at some point in the future, Roddy will get a title shot if he wins. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking, man, this fits perfectly with my idea from last week. You have McIntyre win the match this Wednesday. Now when Roddy comes out at TakeOver, let's say him and Adam Cole and whoever comes out to do this big run-in in the main event, he has a reason to go after Drew McIntyre as well, not just Bobby Roode, right? Because McIntyre just took his one chance away from him to get back at Bobby Roode. It's perfect. McIntyre, by the way, let the cat out of the bag on Sean Waltman's podcast this week that Gabe Sapolsky, who of course runs Evolve, which has a working relationship with WWE, is now also working with NXT behind the scenes in a creative capacity. He spilled the beans, whether he realized he was doing it or not. He told Waltman, he's fantastic, he's in NXT now, he's able to help me out. Gabe is able to say, hey, if we give you a mic in the ring, that's like a stronger area for a guy who really wasn't a promo guy before. Now, we don't know the extent of Sapolsky's role, if he's, you know, being tried out in a certain position, how long he's been doing this for. But Sapolsky had a lot of success as the head booker for Ring of Honor for a number of years. He's done well with Evolve, and to me, the key is that he knows a lot of the guys on that NXT roster right now. He's worked with them before, guys like Roddy, guys like Johnny Gargano, Bobby Fish, Kyle O'Reilly, Cassius Ohno, Oney Lorcan. Like, these are guys in a lot of cases that have worked for him before, be it in Evolve or in ROH. He knows what they're good at. He knows what they may not be so good at. And again, I don't know how much influence he has there, but him being part of that team in NXT sounds like it could be a real plus for a lot of those guys. Danny Burch against Oney Lorcan. Now, Lorcan won the first match that they had, so naturally Burch, you know, won the second match. This was a lot of fun. Hard-hitting, as you would expect, much like their first match, a lot of fun. Lorcan had him in a Boston Crab when Burch rolled through and got the pin. And Danny Burch went for a handshake. Lorcan slapped his hand away. He went to leave. Stopped himself, had second thoughts, came back. He shook Burch's hand. This has to lead to them forming a tag team, unless I'm completely reading this wrong. Not that I wouldn't mind seeing them wrestle one more time, like the rubber match. Maybe even adding it onto the TakeOver card in Brooklyn next weekend. Let them go at it one more time. But to me, this has to be leading to the formation of a new tag team here. And to the point I was making only a few minutes ago, we need more tag teams, right? I like seeing more tag teams. Here's a tag team I would love to see. Right? I would love to see Danny Burch and Oney Lorcan together as a tag team. I think they would be, you know, a lot of fun to watch together. To me, it makes sense coming out the way that they've been building this feud between the two and the handshake, the show of mutual respect. It only makes sense. Unlike the main roster, things do generally seem to make sense on this show, so I hope that's the direction they're going in. Now, that should have ended the show. Instead, we got one more match, as Christian would say. We got Andrade Cien Almas with Zelina Vega in his corner against No Way Jose. That was our main event. Whenever Almas starts to showboat and have fun now, Vega yells at him, tells him to get serious. She's like his mother, only hotter. Almas did get serious. He hit the double knees in the corner on Jose. He finished him off with the hammerlock DDT. As they're leaving, as they're walking to the back, Vega walks over to the announce desk. She picks up a microphone. Now, earlier in the show, Johnny Gargano did a very quick promo backstage. He said he has no match at TakeOver. He wants an opponent for NXT TakeOver. And Vega says, well, if Gargano wants an opponent, then look no further than Andrade Cien Almas. And with that, we have a new match for TakeOver next Saturday night. Which brings us to predictions for NXT TakeOver Brooklyn Part 3. This is the third straight year that they are emanating from the Barclays Center, going back to 2015, which was the night of that classic battle between Sasha Banks and Bayley, and a ladder match between Finn Balor and Kevin Owens that I think often gets overlooked because of that match with Sasha and Bayley. But as somebody who was in the building for that match that night, it is not surprising why, because that match was fantastic. We have Andrade Cien Almas against Johnny Gargano. Almas seems to be the one getting this renewed push here with his new manager. And, you know, Gargano doesn't lose anything by losing here. I don't know if this is a one-off. I don't know if this is the start of a feud between them. But if it is the first match of many, I think Almas is going to take it. So I'm picking him to win. Aleister Black against Hideo Itami. Aleister Black has yet to be beaten in NXT. He's one of the big blooming stars that they have down there. And I'm going to go with Aleister Black. I don't think it's time to beat him yet, so I'm picking him. The Authors of Pain defend the NXT Tag Team titles against Killian Dane and Alexander Wolfe of Sanity. I don't see the Authors of Pain dropping the titles now, so I pick them to retain. This one's a little bit harder. We have Asuka defending her NXT Women's Championship over 500 days as champion as of this coming Thursday. She defends against Ember Moon. I've been going over this in my head now for a while. You guys know my thoughts on Asuka. I really would rather she not drop the championship here and either lose it to Kairi Sane or, frankly, not lose it and go to the main roster still being the NXT Women's Champion. Maybe become the first woman to win a championship on the main roster and hold a championship in NXT simultaneously. I mean, Asuka's setting all kinds of records left and right. Why not set another one? So I'm not ready, even though it's been 500 days, to take the title off of her or see her without the championship. But I just feel like the story that they have set up here for Ember Moon is ripe for a title change. I think this is something that they have been building to, and I think they're going to give it to her. I think we're going to see a new women's champion crown next Saturday night. I think Ember Moon beats Asuka, hits her with the Eclipse, and wins the women's championship. You know, Ember Moon is no slouch. Ember Moon is very good. She's very popular. And she had the first match. Asuka had a cheat to win. Ember got hurt. She's been, training. She came back. She fought her way back. And here she is at TakeOver getting the championship rematch that she's been waiting for. I don't know what happens to Ember if she loses here. There's also that consideration is that while it makes Asuka a bigger deal, what does it do to the other women in this division if they just keep losing, right? At some point, somebody does have to win. You've got to, you know, because Asuka is eventually going to move on. Even if she splits her time for a little while between the main roster and NXT, at some point that's going to cease. Asuka's going to go to Raw or SmackDown, and you're going to have a women's division left over. It's taken them a while to really kind of build this thing back up since they lost Becky and Bayley and Sasha and Charlotte. Because for a while there, this division was dead. D-E-A-D, dead. You could see the friggin' tumbleweed blow by every time there was a women's match at Full Sail. They've built it back up a little bit now, and they have to make sure that, you know, it doesn't go back to the way things were. So I see it from all sides. I still would like Asuka to retain. I don't think she is. I'm picking Ember Moon to win. And we have Bobby Roode in the main event defending the NXT Championship against Drew McIntyre. I think it's too early. You know, McIntyre's done good work. He's had some good matches. He's cut some fiery promos. But up until a couple of weeks ago, they really weren't doing anything with him. The guy was cold as a block of ice. They just were not focusing on him. I feel like you got to have another match. You got to build it maybe to the TakeOver show in November. Do the title change there. It just seems too early. And I'm picking Bobby Roode, by the way. I do think Bobby Roode is going to retain. I don't think it's that much of a stretch to think that we could see something along the lines of the idea that I pitched for a new faction with Roddy. You have to think that Roddy is going to get involved in some way. It depends on what happens at TV this week, but especially if he gets beat and he loses to Drew McIntyre, there's no way that Roderick Strong is not involved in some way, shape, or form in this match. There's just no way. So the idea of pairing him off with someone else or a faction of people, it's not that far-fetched, and I actually like that idea a lot. And having them run in, it buys you some more time to keep that title on Roode and give it a few more months before McIntyre wins it. So that's what I would do. I hope they do that. I think that something along those lines is probably going to happen. I do think we'll probably see Adam Cole, even if it's just a wave from the crowd. But I think it's going to be more than that. So I'm picking Bobby Roode to retain. The Mae Young Classic airs in a few weeks on the WWE Network, so you know. August 28th, to be exact, is when the first, the first batch of first-round matches, maybe the entire first round, drops on that day. They're doing this release like a Netflix release, so you can binge all the episodes at once. I think about a week or two later, they're releasing the next round. And then September 12th, I believe, is the live finals on the WWE Network. Hopefully from Full Sail. I don't know. Again, the plan had been to tape it after SmackDown. And then I heard maybe that changed. I hope it did change. I hope they do it at Full Sail. I think to do it any other way would be a big mistake. But in any event, as you know, this is not really a spoiler, I don't think here, that one of the special guests that was in attendance for the tapings that night, because Triple H tweeted out a photo of it, was the former UFC Women's Bantamweight Champion, Ronda Rousey, who has always been a very big WWE fan, big wrestling fan. Now, I'm not discussing match results here, just so you know, but there is something that happened at the tapings that could be considered a spoiler if it ends up airing. I don't know if it's going to air on TV or not. I would think it will. So I'm going to mention it now because it ties into a news item this week. If you don't want to know anything at all, fast forward. If you are overly sensitive to these things, I'm telling you right now, fast forward by about 3 or 4 minutes. Okay. There was a confrontation that took place at those tapings involving Ronda Rousey and the her fellow MMA four horsewomen friends and the WWE version of the Four Horsewomen. It got a lot of people talking, and now comes word by way of a report from Sean Ross Sapp over at Fightful.com that WWE has referred her, being Ronda, to Brian Kendrick for wrestling training. WWE, if you remember, they referred the now dearly departed Eva Marie to Kendrick for training as well. Dearly departed. She's not dead, but, you know. Well, she may as well be, but anyway. Eva Marie, for a while, was training with Brian Kendrick, and I guess he's sort of the go-to guy that they trust and respect when they have somebody who needs some basic wrestling training, go to Brian Kendrick. That's a nice endorsement of Kendrick. And so this has a lot of people thinking that we may be in for a horsewoman versus horsewoman match, possibly at next year's WrestleMania. I mean, WrestleMania, to me, would be the place that it would make the most sense. Wouldn't be much of a stretch to think that it might happen. There's not a doubt in my mind that Ronda Rousey wants to wrestle a match at some point. At least one. I'm not saying she wants to go on a whole run, give me a Brock Lesnar contract, I'll wrestle 5 times a year. I feel like at least one big pay-per-view match, Ronda would be totally in for that. I don't know what her contract situation is with UFC, if they would allow it, if that's still an issue, I don't know. Is she technically retired? She's been kind of coy about that. We have that consideration to make as well. But there's not a doubt in my mind that Rousey wants to do a match. The other three horsewomen, you have Marina Shafir. She's engaged to Roderick Strong. I mean, hell, if they bring her in, maybe they can make her part of that faction I pitched. But she's engaged to Roddy. She's already made a few cameo appearances on NXT. Shayna Baszler is already wrestling. She's in the Mae Young Classic. And you have Jessamine Duke. She's the other one, she's the blonde, has reportedly already started training at the Santino Brothers Wrestling School. She did a training seminar with Rocky Romero. So they're obviously getting ready for something, right? They're not doing this for the fun of it. And if I'm WWE, that's a huge match for WrestleMania. Even if most people have no idea who the other three horsewomen are, like who? Marina who? Jessamine what? Like, it doesn't matter. Everybody knows who Ronda Rousey is. That's all that matters. She'll give the rub to all the other three. Don't worry about that. To pit the four of them against Charlotte, Sasha, Becky, and Bayley. I mean, Bayley, it is a little weird. You're talking about these women who come from mixed martial arts and you're going to put Bayley in there with them. But still, Bayley is part of that group. You put them in there against Charlotte, Sasha, Becky, and Bayley. That's a big attraction. I don't care what show it is. That's a big attraction. Now, you also have Cyborg. Right? Cyborg Santos. She's built like a brick shithouse, this woman. She's out there sparring on Twitter with Becky Lynch. She's throwing down challenges. I challenge you to a match. I challenge you to a match at SummerSlam. So I was thinking, you know, it would be kind of funny if after all these years of teases, because for years now people have said Ronda versus Cyborg, that's the big match, the big fight, and it's never happened, and it never will. But it would be kind of funny if after all these years of teases between, you know, Ronda and Cyborg and people wanting to see that fight, if their first meeting ended up happening in a pro wrestling match. I think that would be kind of amusing. And I don't know, you know, I was thinking about that. Maybe there's a way, because right now I don't think there's anything to it. I think it's just Cyborg, for whatever reason, got into it, a fun little back and forth with Becky on Twitter, and I think the whole thing is just sort of taken on a life of its own. Who the hell knows if Cyborg would even pass a piss test in WWE? That gets into a whole other host of issues. Who knows if she would even be tested? You know what? I don't think she would be. I don't think The Rock is tested when he comes back. I can almost guarantee that. But I was thinking about this, and, you know, maybe there's a way that WWE can make that happen. Get Cyborg and Ronda in the ring together and tie in, you know, the WWE personalities in there. Maybe a tag match. Maybe you don't do the horsewomen against the horsewomen, which I think would be the better idea. But if you're not going to do that, maybe it's a tag team match, right? Maybe Ronda teams up with Becky Lynch against Cyborg and one of the female heels from the SmackDown brand, since Becky is a star on SmackDown. You do that at WrestleMania. So that way they can do Asuka and Charlotte in a singles match, because I think by the time next year's WrestleMania rolls around, Asuka will be either fully on the main roster or still splitting time between the main roster and NXT. But, you know, for a while now, even going back to this year's WrestleMania, people have floated the idea, ooh, what a dream women's match in WWE it would be to put Charlotte in there against Asuka. So, you know, maybe they have a couple of singles matches in mind and they can't do 4-on-4 at WrestleMania. Well, that doesn't mean you can't still do a tag team match and make it a big attraction. So that's almost like a solid sort of backup plan. It certainly would be a big deal for Becky Lynch. Becky Lynch teaming up in a wrestling match with Ronda Rousey? You don't think that would be big for Becky Lynch? You're out of your mind. That'd be huge for her. So I'm just saying, there's a couple of different ideas, a couple of different ways they could go here. But either way, they look like they've got at least one pretty big attraction lined up for WrestleMania next year, if that's the direction they want to go in. The title of this week's Lucha Underground episode was Bloodlines. This episode had one outstanding match. Pentagon broke multiple arms, and they had a big reveal at the end with one of my favorites, Katrina. So obviously, it's one of my favorite episodes of the season so far. The White Rabbit Tribe got their first trios win here in Lucha Underground. They beat Taya, PJ Black, and Ricky Mandel to win 3 ancient Aztec medallions. Jack Evans was in the Worldwide Underground's corner outside with a whiteboard, writing various messages on it since his jaw was still wired shut when this was taped. Paul London pinned Mandel with a Shooting Star Press. Thought it was fun for what it was. The White Rabbit people are growing on me. We had a quarterfinal match in the Cueto Cup with Mil Muertes taking on Jeremiah Crane. Muertes jumped Jeremiah as he was making his entrance. He sneak attacked him, or as Gorilla Monsoon would say, he Pearl Harbored him. And they ended up fighting all over the building. This was hot right from the start. Bell never even rang. Dario Cueto made it a no disqualification match once he saw them fighting all over the place. This was nuts. This match was absolutely insane. They disappeared somewhere, they went to commercial. When they came back, Matt Stryker was telling us, you know, we're trying to find out where they were, can we get a camera back there? All of a sudden, as he says that, Crane comes crashing through a door. Muertes just throws him through a door. And there he is. We found him. One of the funnier spots was Crane had Muertes, he was sprawled out across this row of seats in the crowd. And he does this thing, Jeremiah does this thing where he, kind of like Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns does this when he sets up like for the drive-by. But Crane takes it to another level. He will jog around the entire length of the ring. He does a lap around the ring, I guess to build up speed. And then he either dives onto the person or kicks him really hard in the face or whatever. So as he's jogging around, he's starting to round the bend. Mil Muertes gets up and he just breaks him in half with a spear. Like, as Crane is coming in, here comes Muertes, who's like twice his size, just shatters this guy, breaks him in half. Finally, they get into the ring for the very first time. Good 10 minutes has already gone by before they even get into the ring. We get chairs brought in. We get tables. In fact, Crane set one up outside the ring. He gets up on the apron. And as he set the table up, he gets up on the apron. Mil Muertes comes charging in for a spear. The Reaper's Trident, as he calls it, right through the table. The problem is that Crane caught the far end of the table, and it barely broke. Reminded me of the spot this morning in the G1 with Omega and Naito, when Naito went to pile drive Omega, and poor guy missed most of the table, hit the edge of the table. One of these days, these guys are going to kill themselves. There's going to be a death on one of these table spots. I hope I'm wrong. But he caught the edge of the table. It looked like it sucked for Jeremiah Crane. Muerte sees the partially broken table. And in wrestling, it's a sin if you don't completely break the table. You can't leave the table partially broken. You got to break the damn thing, right? So the table has to be fully broken, like Matt Hardy. So he powerbombs Crane through what's left of the table. Gets him back in the ring. This thing goes on for several more minutes. So many near falls. So many times I looked and I said, why is this guy kicking out? Just like give up already. This guy, Crane, was taking so much abuse here in this match and getting dropped on his head left and right. Finally, Muertes wins with the flatliner. Katrina comes in for the lick of death, but instead she gives Crane the kiss of death, which pissed off Mil Muertes, gave him another flatliner for good measure. This was as wild a brawl as the Grave Consequences match that Mil Muertes had with Phoenix, which is still my favorite match of all the Lucha Underground seasons so far, so you can kind of tell I enjoyed this, and I think you will too. Definitely find this match, track this match down. If you are into wild, crazy brawls, you won't find a better one this week. We had a scene in Dario Cueto's office with him and a new character that they introduced. This person claims to work for the FBI, a guy named Agent Winter. Only he's not really an FBI agent. Or maybe he is technically an FBI agent, but he is not, from this planet. He has infiltrated the FBI. He is with the Order. The Order is the cosmic group, I guess, that Dario Cueto was part of with Councilman Lorenzo Lamas. Or I should say Councilman Lorenzo Lamas was a part of the Order. That is before Cage killed him. Agent Winter had to break the news. Dario wasn't even aware of the fact that Cage had killed him. So the Order's mission is to usher in the return of the gods, and I guess to destroy civilization. I hope I have this right. I think that's what they want. That, and apparently to run their own Lucha Libre promotion. Agent Winter says, look, I'm a big Pentagon fan. I don't even know why he said that. He goes to leave. As he goes to leave, he turns to Dario Cueto, and he says, and I quote, later, Gator. You could tell this Agent Winterfellow is not from this planet when he uses later Gator as an expression. I haven't heard somebody use that probably since I was 10 years old, and I was the one using it. Main event was Pentagon Dark, Agent Winter's favorite wrestler, against Tejano, as my good friend Famous B would say. This was another quarterfinal Cueto Cup match. Famous B did come out during this match. He had Busty Brenda with him. Beautiful Brenda, I'm sorry. Beautiful Brenda, beautiful Busty Brenda. Famous B, as you know, has been courting Tejano as a potential client for some time now. He threw a horseshoe into the ring behind the referee's back at one point for Tejano to use. The problem is it ended up in Pentagon's hands. And Pentagon waffled Tejano with the horseshoe. He got the pin. He advances in the Cueto Cup. I believe he's actually going to be wrestling Mil Muertes next week in the semifinals, which sounds amazing. Pentagon went to break Tejano's arm when the match was over, but Famous B gets on the microphone. He begs Pentagon not to do it. Don't break his arm. So he didn't. Instead, he broke Famous B's arm for the second time. Remember, he broke Famous B's arm once before, way back in season one. And I'm torn here because on the one hand, I love Pentagon, but on the other hand, Famous B is my guy. So, you know, here's hoping he heals up and he learns from this experience. And that is, when you see Pentagon about to break someone's arm, best to let him do it and not get involved. That's the lesson to be learned here. Brenda gets in the ring. She didn't learn this lesson. Brenda gets in the ring after this happens, right? Proving that she may be busty and she may be beautiful, but she has no brains. Pentagon spots her. He comes back into the ring. He breaks her arm for good measure. Fans chanted Cero Miedo at this, which kind of disturbed me a little bit, I'm not going to lie. But Pentagon stood tall to end the show, having broken not one, but two arms, a male and a female. Closing scene of the show is back in the office of Captain Vasquez at the police station. Someone comes in and says, there's a woman named Katrina here to see you. And she says, oh, send her in. Katrina teleports into the room. It was obvious they knew each other the way they were talking. Vasquez tells her, I need your help. I need your help to get the gauntlet away from Cage. And Katrina is the only one, apparently, with the power to do this. She tells Katrina the gods are coming, and even though Katrina, you know, even though you don't fear them, you should. She made a deal with Katrina after showing her her half of the medallion that she has. Remember, it was split right down the middle. They gave kind of the origin story a while back. It's this necklace, it's this medallion, but it's broken right down the middle. Captain Vasquez has one half. I believe Katrina has the other half, and when you put them together, I don't know what happens. Maybe a Pokemon appears, I don't know. Maybe El Rey finally announces a season 4 or something. Vasquez says, if you get that gauntlet, I'll give you my half of the medallion. And Katrina says, if you do that, you'll no longer be immortal. Vasquez says, I don't fear death, I only fear the gods. And Katrina says, the gods will soon learn to fear death, 1,000 of them. And then as she goes to leave, she comes to the door, and we get the big reveal when she says to Captain Vasquez, well, it seems like we have a deal, Mother. So there it is, another piece of the puzzle. Captain Vasquez is Katrina's mother. Good genes in that family. And that was Lucha Underground. This was a really good episode. You gotta find the Mil Muertes match with Jeremiah Crane. Crane, it's such a weird thing with Crane, because I knew who Sami Callihan was, obviously. He had a lot of buzz around him, and when he got signed and brought into NXT. And from the moment he came into NXT, there was this drop-off. And I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the gimmick, you know, like the hacker gimmick they gave him. I don't know. Even his matches, it just, there was nothing really about him that stood out. There was nothing about him that really impressed me. So then he leaves. I think he asked for his release. He leaves NXT. He's back out on the indies. He's on Lucha Underground. And I'm watching this guy, and this guy goes out there and just has incredible matches. And I'm left to think to myself, well, what happened? What was the difference between Sami Callihan pre and post NXT and the Sami Callihan that we... I don't even remember his name in NXT. I've already forgotten what his name was. Solomon Crow. He's got my friggin' name. How do I forget that? So how we went from pre and post NXT Sami Callihan to Solomon Crow and what we saw from him there, I don't know. I don't know what happened or why there was such a drop-off, why there was such a difference. But, you know, I'm glad he's in Lucha Underground, because he's having great matches and he's tearing it up. Seems to be doing well for himself, so that's good to see. Let's get to some mailbag questions. If you have them, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. There are still people who are not doing that. Please, if you want your question possibly used here on the show, include your name and where you are from. I got a letter from Patrick out in Chino Hills, California. This is in response to last week's show. Remember at the beginning of the show, I was half joking. And I was talking about if I ever had a little Solomonster... There's the joke. I might start them out on all the old school stuff from the 80s and keep them away from the current stuff for a while. Well, Patrick's already done that. He's got two boys, Brandon and Jordan. Shout out to Brandon and Jordan, by the way. He says, even before the network existed, I started them out on that stuff, on the stuff that made me a fan in the late 80s. YouTube and videotapes were my go-to methods. We started watching around WrestleMania 4 in 88 and went from there. I also watched classic NWA with them as well, so they could witness a different style of wrestling. My youngest, Jordan, has become a huge fan of that era because it's his first true memories of pro wrestling. I am proud to say that some of their favorites include the likes of the Ultimate Warrior, Akeem, Ric Flair, Ricky's... Akeem and Ric Flair. My God, how do you go from Akeem to Ric Flair? Ricky Steamboat, Sting, Dusty Rhodes, and Rick Rude. My God, that group that you just mentioned, it's one of those, like, which one of these doesn't belong? Warrior, Rick Rude, Ricky Steamboat, Sting, Dusty Rhodes, Rick Rude, and Akeem. The downfall to that, he says, is that they are not huge fans of today's product. Well, I don't blame them. We now spend Monday nights watching old primetime wrestling episodes instead of Raw because, well, I don't think I have to explain. Brings me great joy to be able to share the memories I had of wrestling as a kid with my own children, and hopefully one day you get to experience that as well. And then he says, if that isn't reason enough to knock someone up, I don't know what is. That's what he says. Well, I don't really think you need a reason to knock somebody up, quite frankly, but if that's your reason, then more power to you. We have an audio question. First one that we've had in a while. This comes from Terrence.
What's happening? This is Terrence Williams at TW talking about on Twitter. And I spent way more time than I would like to admit this week arguing with trolls online over this Sienna pointing out that Charlotte has bitten her style thing. I've seen so many people pile on talking about, you know, Sienna's underpaid and she's a nobody and who is she? Charlotte's a queen, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, time out, dude. Listen, we're not asking the question of who do you like more, right? The question was never, do you like Charlotte or Sienna better? That's the position that people take. Like, why can you not separate defending something that you like from the facts that somebody is putting in front of you? And if you look at the tweet that Sienna posted, she showed the pictures of Charlotte biting her makeup style, Charlotte biting the feathers on top of the neck, the peacock feather style, and even with the pinkies up thing. And I'm like, listen, she's got a solid argument. So I just want to hear another take on this from somebody with an intelligent opinion. Love the show. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Terrence. I appreciate that. I'll be honest with you. I am struggling to care about any of this. I find this to be about as interesting as watching grass grow, as Billy Gunn once told me. I saw the side-by-side comparisons. This idea that Charlotte is stealing her makeup. For those who don't know, Sienna is the Knockouts champion for Global Force Wrestling, and she's been having a back and forth on Twitter because, as Terrence said, she believes that Charlotte has stolen her makeup and has stolen her gesture, this pinky gesture that she has and the feathers that she wears around her neck and all this stuff. The idea that Charlotte is stealing her makeup, I don't see it. I think that's a stretch. The peacock feathers, you know, as Charlotte pointed out on Twitter, her father looked like a giant peacock for over 30 years with all those robes he would wear to the ring. I mean, let's be honest here. If anybody's jacked anyone's style, Charlotte jacked her own father's style, right down to the moves and the mannerisms that she uses in the ring. The pinky thing was like the straw that broke the camel's back for Sienna. She's like, I could deal with the feathers and I can deal with the makeup, but the pinky thing, it's like, if you want anything else from me, that's how this whole thing got started. The pinky thing is ridiculous. It's not even the same thing. Charlotte and Becky have been doing this stupid tea time thing with their hands. I don't know if they've done it on TV. I think they've done it on TV a little bit, but I see it like in some of the YouTube videos and stuff WWE puts out. It's this like tea time. Think Mr. Natty when he used to do that tea time motion and put his pinky up in the air. That's what they've been doing for a while now. Sienna puts her pinky up in the air. You know who it reminds me of? You know who I think Sienna jacked it from? Another WWE star, King Booker. Booker T. When he was King Booker, he used to put his pinky up in the air like that. I could just as easily sit here and say that she jacked it from him, which I'm sure she didn't. But I can sound just as ridiculous as these people do. Robbie from Maryland has a very interesting theory for SummerSlam. What if we get the ultimate twist, and it's the Universal title and not the WWE title that Baron Corbin cashes in on at SummerSlam, with John Cena most likely heading to Raw after the pay-per-view? This could be a way to continue their feud and get John Cena his 17th world title. Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would think if Cena's going to break the record, it ain't going to be at No Mercy. But that is a very interesting pitch. Have they said that Corbin can only cash in on the WWE title? I don't remember them explicitly saying that. Maybe they did, so that's why I'm asking. But I don't remember them really focusing on it has to be for the WWE title. It has to be for the SmackDown brand title. You know, I'm not sure that they've specified that. Now, Cena is booked for Raw TV's after SummerSlam. He is scheduled for a match at the next Raw pay-per-view, which I think is No Mercy. Corbin, I mean, look, who's left for Corbin to feud with on that show after John Cena, you know, in that feud, or if they only have one match, Cena's going to go to Raw and maybe in feud with somebody, so it could be one and done. But beyond Cena, who's left for Corbin? I mean, if you really think about it, he's already feuded with Nakamura. He's already feuded with Sami Zayn. He's already feuded with Dolph Ziggler. Now he's feuding with John Cena. He's not going to feud with any of the other heels. You're not going to see him in there feuding with Kevin Owens anytime soon. So that leaves Orton and AJ. And who else? Him going to Raw, Corbin going to Raw, is not that far-fetched. And you know, think of this. The stipulation for the main event at SummerSlam is that if Brock Lesnar loses the championship in the Fatal 4-Way, because the odds are stacked against him intentionally, according to Paul Heyman, then he and Heyman walk out. So what if he retains the championship in the 4-Way and then Corbin cashes in? That way they get the title off Lesnar, but he gets to stay. He's not under any sort of obligation to leave, because technically he won the Fatal 4-Way. I don't know how likely this is, but Robbie could be onto something here. So that might be something to keep in mind. We'll see a week from now, looking back, if they did in fact go in this direction. But it goes to the heart of whether or not they've made it clear that Corbin can only cash in on the WWE title. If they have, then I guess this is all a moot point. But if not, it could very well happen. Carlos from New York, with Bayley getting booed on Raw, do you think it would be a good idea for her to return as a vengeful heel who goes through the entire roster on her quest for the title? No, I think that would be a bad idea. Bayley is not a heel. Bayley is a babyface. You know, 3 years from now, maybe she could pull it off. She's only been on the main roster for a year. Like, it's bad enough they split up Cass and Enzo after 1 year, or like a year and a few months on television. All of a sudden, they're broken up. To turn Bayley now, I think, would just be idiotic. Danny from London, England. Do you think if Bray Wyatt won the Royal Rumble this year but still lost to Randy Orton at WrestleMania that he would be in a better position than he is now? He would not have won the championship like he did in February, but I feel winning the Rumble would have made him a bigger threat than his short title run did. I feel the only thing that can save him now is a babyface turn. Winning the Royal Rumble would not have meant anything if everything that they had planned for him post-WrestleMania would have been exactly as it was. Like, it's not about winning a big match every now and then, it's about consistency. And that's the thing that kind of drives me mad about somebody like Bray Wyatt, is that he's racked up a couple of big wins recently, but what does it really mean, right? Especially if he goes into SummerSlam and let's say he loses to Finn Balor. Okay, well now he's back to losing. And where does he go from here? It's not even, like, for the longest time with Bray, it wasn't even, well, he's trading wins back and forth. You can't win all the time. Everybody wins one and loses one. It wasn't win one, lose one. Like, he was just getting beat every single time out. You can't take somebody seriously when they make empty threats and they never deliver in the clutch. So, I'm not sure that had Bray won the Rumble, anything would have been different for him. If it would have changed his booking, and because he won the Rumble, they saw him as a bigger deal and they protected him more, that's one thing. But if Bray won the Rumble, goes to WrestleMania and loses, and his April, May, June, July, and August is exactly the same, then it means nothing. If anything, it drags the Rumble down. Danny also wants to know, why did Randy Orton win the Royal Rumble? Looking back, it didn't make any sense for Orton to win over Wyatt. Well, actually, it did. I'm gonna defend WWE a little bit on this. It did make sense because what it did, it set up Randy to turn on the Wyatt family. I don't remember exactly when he joined, but I think he was part of the Wyatts for a while. I think, I'm pretty sure going into the Rumble, he had already been part of the Wyatts. And I think the way they did it, I think the way they broke him away was all wrong. But story-wise, it did make sense to have him win. And then when Bray won the championship, it's like, uh-oh. we have Randy Orton, one member of the Wyatt family, going to WrestleMania to challenge the leader of the Wyatt family for the championship. What's going to happen? I hated the way they handled the reveal, when he burned the house down and all that. I think you could have taken it, frankly, all the way to WrestleMania before revealing that Orton, it was a ruse all along. They messed that up big time. But it actually did make sense for him to win the Rumble if that was the direction they were going in. So I'll defend them on that. And also, there's no doubt in my mind that Randy Orton won the Royal Rumble sort of as a thank you for him taking that ass-kicking he took from Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam last year where he got concussed. To me, that's the only reason he won. I mean, they formulated this storyline plan for him, and so they built to it. So in that respect, they had a plan, they knew where they were going, but the idea for him to win the Rumble and then go on to win the championship at WrestleMania, not a doubt in my mind. That was a nice little give back to him for what he agreed to do. He agreed to do something that I don't know a lot of people would have done, which is go in there and get his head cracked open by Brock Lesnar. Eddie in Northern Ireland, he's been listening since he was 15. He is now 22. Wow. So thank you to Eddie. I've been watching Raw from the Attitude Era for the first time, and I'm loving it. But there are certain things I find hilarious. How did the WWF ever think it would work? Pushing Jeff Jarrett. He came back mocking his previous country gimmick, and then a few months later, after the NWA invasion, he was Country Jeff again. This is so bad, I literally burst out laughing when I see him on my TV screen. Yeah, Jarrett was a joke. He totally did not fit in that first year when he came back. He stuck out in that period of attitude, or whatever you want to call it. He stuck out like a sore thumb. Once he lost the hair match at SummerSlam to X-Pac and he started doing the whole don't piss me off deal and he had, Deborah with him, it got better. Like, I remember him putting Ben Stiller in a figure four once on, I don't know if it was Raw or SmackDown. Once he made that pivot away from the country crap, it was an improvement. But you're right, it made no sense. I mean, he came back doing a work shoot on TV about how awful the Double J thing was, only to go back to doing the Double J thing. Yeah, I almost think they did it on purpose, just to make him look like a fool. Matt from St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada. At Survivor Series 1999, Big Show replaced Steve Austin and won the WWF title in a triple threat match. Who would you have replaced Steve Austin with? Do you think Test would have worked? They still could have had Triple H marry Stephanie instead of Test, and then did Test versus Triple H for the title at Armageddon in a marriage versus title match. Test, I think, would have made a lot more sense than Big Show. Big Show, here's the thing about that. I actually remember being really disappointed when Big Show came out for that main event because Big Show had already wrestled earlier in the show. He was in like a handicap Survivor Series match against two or three other people. He had already wrestled once before. So nobody was expecting him to be the one to come out. When he finally did, it was like, huh? Like, the Big Show. It kind of reminds me of the No Way Out of Texas pay-per-view they did back in 98 after Shawn Michaels had suffered that back injury. He was supposed to be part of like this big 8-man tag or 10-man tag at that pay-per-view heading into WrestleMania 14. Well, he could barely move. So we didn't know who the mystery man was going to be taking Shawn's spot in the big tag team match. Turned out to be Savio Vega. You can imagine the groans from people in the crowd and probably from people sitting at home. You could hear my groan probably a few states away. It's like, what, Savio Vega? Are you kidding me? So there have been a few moments like that, actually. If I go back, maybe one day I'll make a list of like the top 5 or top 10 disappointing moments or disappointing reveals. Snuka coming out at Survivor Series 96 is another one when people thought Rick Rude or the Ultimate Warrior was coming back. But, so Big Show was just a big disappointment in that respect. Test didn't even have a match on the show. So Big Show did. He had already wrestled. Test wasn't even on the pay-per-view. Because I know this because I was trying to figure out when I got your question, well, who did Test wrestle? What was the match that Test had? I couldn't think of it. So I looked up the card and I'm like, holy shit, he didn't even have a match. He wasn't even on the show. Now, this is during a time when Test was pretty over, right? You could say what you want to, but he wasn't a great wrestler. He was too young. He was too inexperienced. Test had just come off maybe the match of the night at SummerSlam. He had that Love Her or Leave Her match with Stephanie McMahon. It was like a wild brawl. The Mean Street Posse got involved. But the story, the match itself, it all just clicked. And they had a great match. And I feel like Test was riding a wave of momentum since that match with Shane. They had him plugged into this major storyline. He was going to marry the boss's daughter. It looked like they had big plans for him. Even if he was just a pawn, just to get to Triple H, and then they were going to kind of, you know, dispose of him. But still, people were into him. He came out, he got reactions, he was very popular. But I guess in this situation, my understanding has always been that Austin, they knew Austin was not going to be able to wrestle. And honestly, this was very shady on the part of this company. And a lot of this sort of bait and switch crap went on back then with WWE and WCW. Apparently, in the case of the 99 Survivor Series, the main event was going to be Austin, Rock, and Triple H for the championship. Big match, right? And Austin comes to them, I don't know if it was a week, I don't know if it was 2 weeks, it was at least a week or two before. They knew Austin couldn't go, but they kept the match anyway. They did the angle where he got run down by a car. So at least they came up with some storyline reason for it. They didn't just come on the air and say, well, Steve Austin won't be here. But still, total bait and switch. They knew in advance. They said nothing about it. So no wonder, like, people were disappointed when Big Show came out to be his replacement. But that was the situation with Austin, okay? And so they felt like they owed the fans something because Austin wasn't wrestling. And I don't think that the title was going to change hands. I think if Austin was healthy and if he was in that match, I think Triple H would have retained. But because Austin got pulled, they felt, well, we have to make good here. We have to go off the air with a big moment and give people a reason to be happy and excited and not pissed off. And that's the only reason why Big Show got the championship. Not a doubt in my mind. Especially when you look at how quickly his run came to an end. He had one pay-per-view title defense, which was arguably the worst pay-per-view title defense in WWE history. And there was a lot about that Big Show, Big Boss Man storyline that was tasteless, but I thought it was funny. I'll be honest, I laughed at a lot of that stuff, okay? The dragging the casket through the cemetery and Big Show doing a flip when he fell off of it. Like, it was a lot. You know, the card, the sympathy card, that Boss Man, totally tasteless, but I laughed. Okay, I will admit, that was one of my guilty pleasure storylines in WWE. I can also sit here and tell you that that championship match was the drizzling shits that they had on that Armageddon show. If it went 5 minutes, I'd be shocked, and 3.5 to 4 of those minutes was literally Big Show laying on the floor outside the ring. I think he got knocked out or something happened. He laid there on the floor. I think it was Big Show, not Boss Man. That was the whole match. And then I think Big Show came in and chokeslammed him, and that was it. The worst championship main event that I can remember, possibly in the history of WWE. Okay? And maybe I'm forgetting a few, but that one sticks out in my mind. A few weeks later on TV, he lost the belt. So the whole thing reeks of, let's just do this now, and in 6 weeks or 8 weeks, we'll get this title off of him. And that's exactly what they did. Okay? So, but that was their rationale. We have to do a title change. We have to have a feel-good moment. But you could have done that with Test. I mean, what does it matter if he's not ready, if he's inexperienced? You're going to take it off him anyway. At least the guy's over. At least he didn't already wrestle a match on the show. At least he's popular. At least he's already associated with, you know, Vince McMahon's daughter. He's in a big storyline. Why not plug Test in there? Think about it. Test wins the title. It makes total sense a week or two later on TV, whatever it was, that Triple H would screw him over, steal his fiance away from him, marry her. They have a match at the Armageddon pay-per-view, and Triple H wins the championship back. And you could still do the whole thing where Stephanie turns on Test instead of Stephanie turns on Vince. That could have worked. I'm not saying Test was this supremely talented guy who cut great promos and all this. He wasn't, but he was over. And he was capable in the ring. I don't know why they didn't do more with him, to be honest with you. It's just, that whole thing just ended so abruptly. I can't remember what Test did after that. The only thing I remember is TNA, him and Test and Albert with Trish Stratus as their manager. But that came, I think, months later. It's like he fell off a cliff. Was that Triple H being, you know, jealous of him behind the scenes and playing politics? Was there something else involved? Was it his own behavior? I don't know. I'd love to know more about that. I'd love to know more, you know, on why. Maybe that's something Bruce Pritchard or somebody like that could answer. I don't know. But, after the wedding angle, they never followed up on it. It was Triple H and Vince. Think about that. He stole the guy's fiance away from him. Would it not have made more sense for Tess to want to go for revenge? Anyway, I agree. I think Tess would have made more sense. Andrew, I was thinking about Brian Pillman recently and how he was the closest thing WCW had to Shawn Michaels in their early days. Then I got to thinking that they could have had what might have been somewhat of a dream match in WWE when Pillman was there. Do you have any idea why this match didn't happen, whether it was timing, Pillman's injuries, or if there was any heat between the two because of Pillman's close relationship with Bret Hart? I don't think that his relationship with Bret had anything to do with him not wanting to work with Shawn Michaels. I think it was completely timing and his injuries. I was thinking back to when Pillman started. He came in, he had that press conference in June of 96. So he had already had the Humvee wreck. He signed anyway with WWE, because that Humvee wreck for him came at the worst possible time. He was in the middle of... Eric Bischoff didn't know about this, because they were trying to sell the reality of this loose cannon gimmick, so he actually had the powers that be at Turner fax him a legitimate release, not knowing that at the same time, Pillman was negotiating with WWE. So he comes in, he can't wrestle, because he's got these severe injuries to his leg, to his ankle. He's still recovering. They bring him in anyway. He was doing commentary. He was doing in-ring interviews. Anyway, he has to go for a follow-up surgery a few months later. And that's when they did the angle where Steve Austin Pillmanized him. That's where the whole term Pillmanized come from. Put the chair on his ankle, crushed the ankle. Pillman went away for several more months. So all this time is going by. He can't wrestle. When Pillman came back, it was April or May. I don't remember exactly. It was definitely after WrestleMania, but it was either April or May of 97. He reemerges. And now he's associated with the Hart Foundation. I don't know when he had his first match in WWE. I don't think he was wrestling right away. It may not have been until June, honestly. I know he had the match on TV with Steve Austin after the King of the Ring. They were going to have a match at the King of the Ring. I'm trying to remember. I think the reason it got shifted over to Raw was because it was going to be Bret and Shawn in that 10-minute match. Remember that? And I guess it was either Bret's knee. He was in the wheelchair. Remember, either his knee wasn't fully healed from the scope, or this was around the time that Bret and Shawn had their little pull-apart brawl, in the backstage area. That match got canceled. And the new match at the King of the Ring in 97 was Stone Cold against Shawn Michaels, who just so happened to be tag team champions at the time. And they had a great match. They had a better match than they had at WrestleMania the year after. So Pillman this whole time just isn't wrestling. Now when he finally starts wrestling around June or so of 97, there's just no opportunity for him to wrestle. When does he wrestle Shawn? You're going to do a random match on TV? So you go to SummerSlam. That's where Shawn screws over Undertaker in the main event by accident with the chair shot. Bret wins the title. Shawn begins his heel turn. Now he's going into a feud with the Undertaker. The timing just never worked because Pillman was hurt for so long and couldn't wrestle. And when he came back, Shawn was already turning heel. He was feuding with the Undertaker. And the night that he and Undertaker had the classic Hell in a Cell match, the first Hell in a Cell, that's the day that Pillman passed away. Now, had Pillman not died, would they have had a match? I don't know that they would have, honestly. I just think the timing, even if Pillman didn't pass away, would not have worked out. Shawn was entrenched in this feud with The Undertaker. Then he got hurt at the Royal Rumble. He dropped the belt to Austin at WrestleMania 14, and he was gone. He didn't wrestle for 4.5 years. So I don't think we ever would have gotten a Shawn Michaels-Brian Pillman match, even if Pillman didn't die that night. And had they had a match, I think people's expectations would have far exceeded what the two of them would have been able to do. You know, Pillman could just do basic stuff, but this was not the same Brian Pillman that people remember from WCW. This wasn't Flying Brian. Okay, this was a completely different person. He had his ankle fused. He was always in pain. He wasn't as mobile as he used to be. I mean, there's a reason why there's no classic Brian Pillman matches in his WWE run. A, it was so short, but B, he couldn't go at that level. He just couldn't. So it was probably for the better, to be honest, that they never did have a match, because I don't think it would have lived up to people's expectations. You do that match back in 95, that's a different story. But Pillman, and I know I've talked about this on the show before, Pillman will go down as one of the great what-ifs in WWE, because he was, I mean, that loose cannon gimmick was the real deal. He lived that gimmick. And when he was healthy, he was a great wrestler. And had he been healthy, and had he been around during the Attitude Era doing that gimmick, he would have been a top guy. And coming out of WrestleMania when Austin won the championship, it would not have been Austin against Dude Love. It would have been Austin and Brian Pillman, the two former tag team partners, and the two of them, I think, would have traded that championship back and forth in 98. That's what I think would have happened. It's one of the great sort of tragic wrestling stories that he got hurt, and that ultimately led to his downfall. Again, if you have questions, keep emailing them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I read everything that you guys send me, even if I can't get to everything on the air, although I do try. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. It's going to be kind of a crazy weekend coming up next weekend with all the SummerSlam stuff going on. I may or may not be going to some of the shows. At the very least, I will be a few blocks away from Barclays in Brooklyn at the KBH, the King's Beer Hall. Next Saturday, August 19th at 2 p.m., we have our big sound-off meetup. Second year in a row that we're doing this in the same place. We had a lot of fun last year. Hopefully I'll see a lot of familiar faces again this year. I look forward to seeing everybody there. Anything that's going on that weekend, I'll be able to keep everybody updated on Twitter, @Solemonster. So definitely follow me on there. There'll be some new content going up on the YouTube channel as well coming out of SummerSlam. So please subscribe if you have not already done so. YouTube.com/TheSolemonster. That is the official Sound Off channel for all of our extra bonus content. You'll find the Fire Pro Gamer video on there. A couple of new crate unboxings on there as well. And of course, a big SummerSlam review coming up next weekend after the show as well. I'm out of here. I will be back next Sunday at some point. Hopefully, you know, I can't tell you how late or how early I'll be able to get it up, but there will be a normal podcast. That'll be episode 509. That is next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. Thank you for all of your continued support. And I will see you back here next weekend. So until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants," and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Solemonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solemonster sounds off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster sound off.